This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And whatever comes our way, yeah, I gotta go make it happen. Take the world in a loving embrace.
Sorry, everyone. That was an electrified thug from Batman Forever. And I'd like to welcome you all.
We're not doing that again. We're done with that. We're leaving it in the past.
Like to...
We're moving on. We are not covering that ground again, quite frankly.
I'd like to welcome you all to an edition of Hard Traveling Fanboys, where we are going to go on a little excursion where we turn into the Longbook Hunters.
We turn to people who might have characteristics not unlike those who have the potential to become individuals who one day might potentially read long books.
That's right. And as the electrified thugs from Batman Forever who opened the show would indicate, this is an electrifying episode of Hard Traveling Fanboys that you can get ready for. I, of course, am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is the interrupting Nick Duke. Nick, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, and quite frankly, I would suggest that my interruptions are what give our show its certain charm, its certain... It's certain what the French,
what the French call
a certain, I don't know what.
I don't know what. Or would it be what the French call a certain, I don't know what.
What? I like that. I like that better. Because, you know, as you and I have discussed offline before, our podcast is really just an extension of what it's like whenever you and I are having conversations in real life. And I think we capture that and bring it to the table. But we do so without making disparaging comments about Mauro Ranallo.
Nick, I lost you.
I can hear you, sir.
Nick, I lost you completely.
Hello, sir.
You blacked out for like, yep, hello?
I'm recording, so everyone heard everything I just said. So let's just move on.
All right. Fair enough.
I made a joke about bringing stuff to the table and Mauro Ranallo, if you must know.
Oh, well, let me reinsert a... oh, we'll fix that in post, folks.
No, we won't.
But what we won't fix in post... is everything else, and that included. And also, our look at the iconic namesake for this show. You see, folks, if you didn't pick up on it for the last,
year?
Combined 4 years that we've been been called the Hard Traveling Fanboys, it is our loving homage to a run of comic books from the 1970s by Dennis O'Neill and Neil Adams.
Dennis O'Neill, wow.
Going Green Lantern, that's how he's listed in the credits in this book, my friend. Green Lantern, co-star on Green Arrow. And while it was never called this at the time, it has somehow taken the affectionate title, The Hard Traveling Heroes. This is an entire era of Green Lantern and Green Arrow stories. And as such, we... have been putting this off and putting it off and putting it off for years now, and finally, we're going to sit down and we're going to review our namesake, and we're going to look at the 1970s Green Lantern and Green Arrow stories. And because there are so many of them, because it is so expansive, we are having to split this into two. So this is actually a part one of this long book hunt.
And
we're going to read.
And which part will be coming next week, Greg? If this is part one, next week we'll have what exactly?
Next week we'd have part two. and so we're dividing our long book hunt in half. But I think you're going to find that we're going to delve into some really interesting material here and a style of comic book that is not done anymore.
No.
A density and a pace that is just not done anymore. And it's going to be a very interesting discussion, and it made for an interesting read, Nick, because as we'll probably talk about when we get to it later in the podcast, it is a different time investment to read one issue of this than it is to read an issue in 2017 of a new comic. There's different time investment. There's a different flow of the reading. There's a different level of just a different approach to the what would you call it?
To the genre.
Yep. And so we'll touch on that a little bit later. But what we wanted to do this week is switch things up on you. You might say we want to shake things up a bit because it's been a huge news week in the world of comic books. Would you agree, Nick?
Absolutely huge. I agree.
Yes, and because it's been such a big week in the world of comics, we have decided that we have no choice but to start the show off with a supersized edition of
Welcome to the
Righto. So,
you know how we could have improved that jingle, Greg?
How's that?
Is it, instead of, you know, that unnamed individual doing the guitar parts, what if we had JR doing that mouthed guitar? What would that sound like?
Do 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 do.
I figured it sounds something like do 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 do
do do do do. Do.
Oh, do, do.
I have been watching you people create do-do over the airwaves for 1 year now. When are you going to provide something that anyone wants to listen to, for God's sake?
Well, quite frankly, we'll be doing that with the first ever installment of Place to Be Nation Pop Comic Book Theater, but well, that's for another time and another place.
That's right, and while we're talking about big news events, I will tell people to head on over to the Twitter.com or to the Facebook.com and click on a little on a little story that certain someone has recently put up on ProWrestlingStories.com. Every click counts, folks, and on it you can find links to all the greatest podcasts about professional wrestling that you could hope to find.
You know,
some podcasts that even appeal to those who aren't fans of pro wrestling. Podcasts such as the Hard Traveling Fanboys. You may have heard of it.
You know, Greg, you haven't ever listened to this podcast, but the old Japanese Talking Shops, often, and by often, I mean virtually every episode, Luke Gallows would say something to the effect of, and if you truly love pro wrestling in all its forms, from the independents all the way up to the big time, the best way to support the art form known as pro wrestling is to go to prowrestlingtees.com/biglg and buy a shirt. That'll really help the business. And that's what you sound like right now.
Hey, I think that if more people would show their support for grassroots writers, it could really be a boon for both industries, both pro wrestling and comic books, and also podcasts.
I agree. And so as a result of that, I'm just assuming that this writer you speak of, who put whatever piece this is together that you're talking about, he'll be doing future works for the same website?
Anything can happen, Nick, in the World Wrestling Federation. Anything can happen.
Are you suggesting that the fake Greg Phillips is going to start doing stories for pro wrestling for prowrestlingstories.com?
I am suggesting that in the World Wrestling Federation, anything can happen.
Glenn Jacobs.
The new generation. Nick.
Glenn Jacobs will soon be playing the role of Greg Phillips.
If he's not the mayor of bumfuck Tennessee or wherever he is,
I picked him for the gap tooth. I think he'll be able to pull it off.
Shut up.
Yeah! Woo!
Here's the difference between me and Glenn Jacobs. Glenn Jacobs has the money to get his gap tooth fixed, but he doesn't.
That's true.
He does it because he rocks it, and he knows he rocks it.
That's true. That's a good point. Can't disagree with that. What are we talking about again?
We're talking about Marvel's legacy.
Are we? Did we ever
yes.
set that up?
That's the biggest news of it, or one of the two or three biggest news events of the week. Marvel Comics has announced that it is kicking off yet another new initiative this fall, but this one is titled Legacy, and stop me if you've heard this before, but it will, quote, embrace our roots and move enthusiastically forward, according to, end quote, according to Chief Creative Officer Joe Quesada, or as Nick affectionately calls him, Joey Q.
Joey Q.
So
Joey Q
this
and Danny
announced.
D doing the best for the business for about, what, 20 years now.
That's right. Like. We've talked about Joey Q, and we'll get to Danny D a little bit later.
No.
Why don't they do like a buddy cop show, you know? I feel like they would, I don't know, I feel like there's something there. But
I feel like there's something there in the idea of them joining Chris O'Donnell and the cast and crew of Gotham on a rocket ship that I suggested on Twitter earlier this week and making a beeline straight for the sun. But that's neither here nor there.
If you strike them down, they shall become more powerful than you could possibly imagine.
Oh, God, a force ghost version of Dan Didio will return, and just every version of Dick Grayson across the multiverse will just be murdered.
Yep, instantly. No explanation given. They'll just be wiped from existence.
Wiped from existence.
And we will be told that he never existed.
He's
just not the right character.
The Dan Didio and the Vince Russo voices are slowly have for years been merging into one.
Yeah, along with a little bit of the Taz voice.
A little bit of, it's those three that are, they form something of a Venn diagram, and slowly their centers are converging.
Rocket Buster, bullshit politics in the back, character.
Oh God, we're in rare form tonight.
Never happened, Steve. Oh, so anyway, announced during Marvel's Next Big Thing panel at Chicago's C2E2 on Saturday, Legacy's quote. Jeez, oh God.
Good Lord, we got a throwback to WTBF, Greg Phillips from back in the day, right there.
As someone who writes public relations for a living, I love public relations in regards to comics, Nick.
You have to.
Here it is. Take a shot, my friend, because bold new direction.
Bold new direction. Woo. Anyway,
we'll begin with a 50. Oh.
Gregory?
A 50-page. Your favorites, Nick, and my, and some of mine as well. The great creative team behind Thor, God of Thunder.
Hey, for those who may not have been able to hear what Greg just said, he said it's going to start with a 50-page one-shot. Continue.
By Jason Aaron and Esad Ribich.
Absolutely.
The creative team behind Thor...
I don't think that the issue with people being able to hear you, Greg, was the speed of your speech. There's no need to Triple H this promo.
The Earth shattering return of a beloved Marvel mainstay will be featured in the story. Speculated to be perhaps the Fantastic Four, perhaps Professor Charles Xavier. Perhaps a number of characters who have died over the years, and Wolverine as well. Anyway, and we'll continue through with the publisher's long-running titles reverting back to their original numbering, whatever that means. So, Marvel Legacy.
Mm.
Big picture, this is essentially Marvel Rebirth. This is marrying the old and the new together. Bringing back the presumably bringing back the classic Marvel heroes to work alongside their youthful brethren. Nick, what do you make of this announcement, and what does it mean moving forward for Marvel Comics relative to its current situation?
Well, I'm not. It's hard to say because, you know. First of all, this is something that if you go back and listen to our year-end podcast from last year, when we had the question that was posed, what would you most like to see in comics in 2017? This was actually my answer. I said I wanted to see Marvel take a rebirth-style approach to its publishing line. And that's something that's been rumored for a little bit, and it looks like it's finally going to happen this fall with a refocusing on these core characters. I think what will help to separate it from Rebirth, in my opinion, is Marvel, honestly, has been more dedicated and devoted to the pushing of new characters over the last 5 years or so than DC was. DC only really got focused on that during the DCU era that was very, very short-lived, or short-lived, depending on your perspective. And so when Rebirth came along for DC, there are a few of the newer characters who were big-time focuses, but really the focus was on the core. And I think Marvel is going to seek to take something more of a middle ground approach between Rebirth and what their current strategy is. Try to have their cake and eat it too, for a lack of a better term. But I think we all knew that.
Well, I mean, yeah, and I think that as we've seen with some of the elevation of various events over the years, and the constant bold new directions that have taken place in Marvel and DC as well, but particularly in Marvel with the yearly event cycle, you might say that there used to be a little, but the little wouldn't do it, and the little got more and more. And, you know, and then from there on, they ended up dancing with Mr. Brownstone.
Yeah. So, anyway, I'm completely thrown off. You have rattled me to my core now, because I have no idea what you're talking about. But that's neither here nor there. You talk now.
So, the return of various traditional Marvel characters to their prominent roles. Like you said, it's something that many of us have... many people out there, anyway, have looked for, yourself included. It is potentially, anyway, a return to some sort of consistent status quo for the major lines, mm-hmm. which has kind of been missing for a while, it feels like. But, you know, like you said, there's a lot of variables here. There's a lot of... potential for things to go right, potential for things to go wrong. How do they balance the incredibly important new and diverse characters? I think particularly of Miss Marvel, Kamala Khan. I think particularly of Miles Morales. I think particularly of X-23. Mm-hmm. You know, how will they balance these young, diverse characters with their older counterparts who tend to be old white guy, or not old white guys, just white, you know, white guy.
White, heterosexual, yeah. Largely, you know, Christian males.
Right. And then how do they balance that, and how do they keep their continuity intact without some sort of, I don't know, rebirthian type manipulation with continuity, if that makes sense.
Well, Marvel has been doing this for a little while now, where their relaunches are really seek to kind of shift the focus and the tone of the line for a time. And I think it's possible to do, because in the cases you just pointed out, most of the two of those cases anyway, in the case of characters like Miss Marvel and Captain Marvel, they've already been coexisting without any issue
right.
for some time.
Right.
Miles Morales and Peter Parker, to this point, have been able to coexist in the main universe without any real issue, because the two titles have such different focuses in terms of what each is seeking to accomplish that it's not really an issue. And I think there is potential for that to continue across the line. I think what the real important part of this is, it's going to be taking characters like Peter Parker and characters like Tony Stark and characters like Captain America and Bruce Banner and, you know, various other instances of those characters where they were replaced at a certain point, you know, with newer legacy characters. And in the midst of telling that story, it felt like those original characters got so far adrift from what their core is, and that they almost didn't feel like the same character anymore. Peter Parker is a perfect example. Peter Parker being a multimillionaire and running a Parker yep. Industries as a globe-hopping CEO is not the Peter Parker that I know and love. And so I think there are other instances. You know, Hydra Cap, as much as I will talk about that in a little bit, you know, Iron Man being in a coma at the end of Civil War II, various examples of
these. Also, in recent years, Iron Man has gotten dangerously far from his original character of being really boring.
That's a good point. But no, I think that the idea here will be not to necessarily de-emphasize the newer characters. I think they'll still have their own titles. They'll still be an integral part of the Marvel Universe. But I think you will see for the big hitter, so to speak, bring them back to closer to center, bring them back to their core, and make them the main focus of these big. I would be highly surprised if we didn't see an Avengers book that had more of a classic Justice League type lineup where the biggest hitters in the Marvel Universe were all on the table. I mean, you've already seen a little bit of this approach, honestly, with Resurrection in terms of trying to get the X-Men back to what they once were, you know, in terms of the things that people found appealing about them in the 90s.
Right. But here's the main difference with the X-Men and the Avengers. The Avengers historically are very similar in their appearance, and the X-Men historically are very diverse. So I think there is, you know, when DC rebooted Justice League with New 52, for better or worse, character-wise, they chose to elevate Cyborg and make him a founding member of the Justice League precisely to add diversity.
But they did that while also putting him alongside the big six, so to speak, the classic heroes of the DC universe. It was a little bit of both, and I think you will see a similar approach to that with Marvel, where I think it's hard to imagine there won't be an Avengers title that features Iron Man, Captain America, Hulk, and Thor, while also managing to work in possibly the Falcon or, you know, somebody else to help diversify the roster a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I am not saying this is going to be I think people think that you're either 100% emphasizing only diverse characters and only the newer characters, or you're only 100% emphasizing the classic characters. I mean, how many times, Greg, do we hear during the build up to Rebirth from individuals who thought that they were throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and this was just rejecting all the progress that DC Comics had made? And then when it actually happened, we found out that wasn't the case at all, that there was still a place for those characters. It was just more about getting back to the themes and the ideas that make the DC Universe what it is. And I think there's going to be an element of that with Marvel as well. Because for better or for worse, the Marvel Universe has always been more of a reflection of our real world than the DC universe. And I think you're going to continue to see that in diversity of characters going forward.
Here's the other thing, though. That brings me to a great point that I wanted to drop on you here, a great topic that we can discuss. Does it feel as if with this event, and it's really been happening for a number of years, but does it feel as if Marvel has kind of strayed from its...
Does it feel as if Marvel has done what now?
But along those lines,
sorry, Greg, you're breaking
the
up.
The constant deaths and resurrection.
Greg, you're breaking up a little bit. Can you restate the question for me?
Yeah, sorry, I don't know what the deal is right now. I'm trying to remember where I was at. Does it feel like Marvel and DC, they used to be defined by certain characteristics? For instance, like you said, Marvel was a reflection of the real world. DC was more fantasy. Marvel was, each character was his own unique individual or her own unique individual. DC was built on legacy. Well, it feels like the lines have been blurred between the two now, where Marvel is, as this event is called, Marvel is almost defined by legacy now.
Mm-hmm.
And in DC, we see titles that are traditionally based in fictional cities now based in real-life cities, Seattle and Green Arrow. And, of course, the Titans have always been based in New York. But you see that a lot more in DC now than you used to necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So the question that I have is, does it feel like the two companies have kind of, over time, lost what made them distinct from one another? And what I mean by that is, and it's strange for me to think about a Marvel Universe where you're going to have three Wolverines, two Captains America, I don't know how many Hulks, trying to think of who else has the exact same name. That may be it. Two Icemen, two Beasts. It's strange for me to think about a company that was once so defined by its individualism, now defined by legacy. Is that – am I nuts for perceiving that, or is that just kind of a natural evolution of Marvel from the get-go as it's become more embracing of the fantasy aspects? And likewise on DC's side, is it natural that it would more reflect modern society and real life, so to speak, issues than it once did?
Wow, that's quite a question. I'll seek to answer it as best I can. I think from the Marvel perspective, Marvel, in seeking to be more of a reflection of our real world, has been more responsive to the demand for diversity in characters than has DC to this point. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. I think Marvel also, though, knows that it's a business, and that just creating new characters to help with diversity and having them be largely unrelated to any previous character doesn't typically bode well for those new characters. It's a crutch. Absolutely, it's a crutch. But I think in an effort to continue to reflect the demand for diversity, that's why the legacy aspect of Marvel has come into play. I mean, look at most of the legacy characters that they've created. Falcon was a pre-existing character, but he was a black man serving as Captain America, which is something that's been, you know, never really done before. Jane Foster, a woman as Thor. Miles Morales, a Hispanic/African-American teenager as the new Spider-Man. Miss Marvel, a Muslim as a superhero. So it's all these different ideas that they just happen to tie to pre-existing characters to help, I think, to help them survive, I think, financially. And then the great thing was, in the case of those characters, they all caught on in their new roles, and they've kind of run with it from there. But I think there still is an opportunity for Marvel to focus on those things that it once did in terms of this. Like, the Marvel universe, from its earliest days, is always based on science and this idea of exploration and the idea of experimentation and just this creative wave. And I think you'll see some returns of those concepts. I think the Fantastic Four will probably be put back on the table as a result of this Marvel Legacy event. And I think you're going to see not just a refocusing on core characters, but, you know, some of those larger ideas and themes, in the same way that Rebirth focused on ideas like love and hope and optimism, whatever the themes of Marvel Legacy will be, because you got to remember, we're 5 months away from that. We are going to be guessing a lot, just like we were when Rebirth was announced for the months leading up to that. So I'm optimistic about this. I think it's got a lot of potential, and it's something that I think we've all kind of been wanting to see Marvel do, was to get back to the core and make it so that the casual fan could walk into a comic shop again and mostly know who the characters were. And I think this is absolutely a step in the right direction. Now, in terms of titles themselves and the legacy numbering and all that kind of stuff, not sure how any of that's going to work, because I don't know creative teams, I don't know pitches, I don't know anything about that. The numbering thing, I think, is a little overblown, honestly. I don't think that's that big of a deal, because Marvel has played fast and loose with their numbering for decades. Not just years, decades now. So I don't think that's that much of a story. But it's still kind of a cool nod to see them embracing the historical aspect of their characters rather than constantly seeking to chill number ones. Well, but they need to stick with it for a while. They don't need to just next year launch at number one again.
Right, which, you know, is the fear that they'll do. But I think I mentioned this in a Facebook group, and I guess I'll reiterate it here because people haven't heard that. So I think that the numbers argument in comics of these companies constantly renumbering, because they say, well, it's easier to get in on the ground floor of a number one issue, I think that's such a cop-out. I think it's always been a cop-out. For 60 years of the comic book industry, the number on a comic book had nothing to do with dissuading people from picking it up. And why do I know that for a fact? Because every significant sales boom in the history of comics came at a time when there were comics that were in there, you know, sometimes in their hundreds numbers-wise. The late 80s and early 90s, or Batman and Detective Comics were in their hundreds. Action Comics was in the hundreds. Uncanny X-Men in the hundreds. You know, and these sold millions, literally millions of copies. And because there were hooks. You could pick up a book, and if you had never read a comic book before in your life, you could pick up that book and be drawn into the story. And I think that comic book companies have used this numbers argument as a cop-out, and you know, done it as like a sales gimmick and say, look at our number ones. But then ultimately, the readership, the actual base readership, doesn't change.
And if anything, it actually has been – Marvel has shown over the years that their number one relaunches have gotten subsequently weaker as time has gone on, overall anyway.
I guess it's like anything that, you know, if you saturate the market, it loses value.
Right.
And, you know, now that we've seen this happen over and over again, and it's the same thing for DC with the renumberings as well. So, yeah, the legacy, I think, is a very exciting thing. I think my worry, and admittedly, I don't read much Marvel Comics at all, or any right now, except when we do long book hunts on it. But my worry about it is that it will lose the distinction between the companies. In other words, the Flash family and all that stuff that kind of makes DC DC, now you're going to have that same thing in Marvel. And I don't know, there's a little, I don't really want to see five Hulks or three Wolverines.
Well,
I kind of and even if you, and it's not, I'm not saying I need to see the original iterations of these characters. I couldn't care less. If you want to kill off Steve Rogers, by all means, and bring in a new Captain America, or have a character that fills his role or whatever, I'm cool with that. It's just strange to me to see the two companies be so similar in their approaches. And I know DC is guilty of that, was guilty of that for many times over the years, such as in the 90s, when they Marvelized their universe, essentially. But it's like, I don't know, that's my fear about it. But I do think this is a step in the right direction. I think my hope is that they do fudge with the continuity a little bit and make things a little streamlined for people, so that you can jump in on the ground floor.
I think that's going to be a major focus is, you know, again, status quo and core of these characters, make it easy for new readers to jump in. And, you know, to speak to your point about the legacy thing, we just don't, like, that. Yes, the event is called Legacy, and I'm sure Legacy will be a major part of it, but we don't know specifically what the plans for each of these characters are. I mean, we are still, again, 5 months away from this one shot that's going to kind of lay the groundwork on which this entire, you know, initiative is going to be built. So I think we need to, this in the same way that we gave Rebirth the benefit of the doubt, because if there's anybody at Marvel right now that I would trust to write such a title, it's Jason Aaron. I have a massive amount of faith and trust in the guy, and so I am willing to give him the benefit of the doubt at this point. You know, we often talk about how you and I both, we are DC guys. You know, I think you're a little bit more dyed-in-the-wool of a DC guy than I am, because I was once a Marvel guy and have kind of come over to DC gradually over the years. But something we also discuss here is how we kind of hate that constant war between the two fan bases. Comics are comics, so we should probably be pulling for this to succeed. And, you know, all the snark and jokes can be left at the door, in my opinion.
I agree, although you are the king of snark and jokes about things, so
I'm saying that this is something we have pushed for and asked for as a larger comics community, at least on its face, as it's being described to us. So let's be happy about it. Let's celebrate it, and let's embrace it, and move forward.
Only be snarky, remember, folks, if it's something that Nick wants you to be snarky about.
That's right. Absolutely. I'm glad you understand the rules, Greg.
So Batman Forever, on the table.
On the table, yes. Batman Forever's on the table.
But no.
Fried green tomatoes and school ties, also on the table.
No, not school ties. Not school ties.
School ties
is a good movie.
You and Jennifer Smith accusing me of never having seen Fried Green Tomatoes was hilarious.
Well, it's the only assumption I can make. It's the only assumption I can make.
The only assumption you can make. Quite frankly, I have forgotten more about Fried Green Tomatoes than you ever knew.
I just ate Fried Green Tomatoes the other day.
They're not very good, are they?
No, I love Fried Green Tomatoes. Oh. These weren't very good, though. These were at a certain barbecue joint in Dothan that is a chain restaurant that but they did not have very good fried green tomatoes. The barbecue was good, though.
In any event, Marvel Legacy, thumbs up for me as it's being described to us.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a good thing. The issue for me, as with all of these events, and we'll talk about DC in a minute as well, but the issue for me with all these announcements is I just don't have the money to buy any more comics.
That's a concern. Although Marvel,
I hate to say that because, like, you know, if I have my way, I would be buying more books at DC, and I would be buying at least 3 or 4 or 5 Marvel books and tons of Image books. But I just don't have the disposable income to buy these, in my opinion, overpriced single issue comics.
True, but with the reinstatement of Marvel's digital code program, there will be opportunities for people like myself to get in at a little bit of a cheaper rate and at least try out some books that I wouldn't normally try out. Again, but a lot of that's dependent on creative team and pitches, which we won't know for months now, I'm assuming.
Right. And, again, getting some of these characters out of a little bit of the muck that they've been mired in for a while, namely Spider-Man in particular, I think is going to be a good thing.
I am pledging right now, I will buy 5 copies of the new Spider-Man if they boot Dan Slott off the title. 5
what
copies,
if they,
Marvel.
What if they boot Dan Slott and replace him with Grant Morrison?
Oh, for God's sake, Greg, why do you have to ruin everything? You've ruined it, damn it.
I wonder, though, if Grant Morrison would be a good Spider-Man writer. I don't know. I don't know if he's ever fooled with Spider-Man much, but who knows?
But it's best we just leave that one to be.
Let's move on to our second story of the rundown.
Yes.
Let's move on to, speaking of, we mentioned earlier, Captain Marvel and Ms. Marvel. Well, Marvel is getting ready to put out its very first female-led superhero film, and it will be Captain Marvel, not Black Widow. And this one's going to be starring Brie Larson. And they recently announced...
Oh, my. You weren't lying about that photo, by the way.
Yeah. Newsarama. Unique. Marvel has announced the hiring of Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck to direct Captain Marvel. Now, these two are the directors of Mississippi Grind, a movie I've neither seen nor heard of. They're going to direct the film Captain Marvel, and it will begin filming February 2018 for a March 8th, 2019 release date. I don't know about you, Nick. I don't know much about these directors. I've never heard of Mississippi Grind. But it is nice to know that this movie is actually moving forward in development. That's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely good to hear that they're making progress. Again, I don't know anything about the directors, but kind of makes sense from Marvel's perspective, given that they have a pretty strong studio oversight over their films, that you would want to bring in, you know, directors that probably aren't big names and probably wouldn't have a lot of cachet to come in and start, you know, making power plays and whatnot. People who are going to come in and largely make the movie that Marvel wants to make. So, don't know anything about them, but good to hear we're moving forward.
Is it too late to make a cachet me outside joke?
Oh, good Lord.
Probably so.
You know, when last I was at your apartment in person, I heard you make a how bow dad reference, and I shuddered inside at the state of things.
No, I was actually trying to say how about it, but I forgot that it was how about it instead of how about dad. I was conflating Pete Rose with the
Dr. Phil girl.
The Dr. Phil girl.
How did that become a thing, by the way? I don't know how the internet works anymore.
The internet beat something into the ground.
The internet is a place where people come together to bitch about movies and share pornography with one another.
Yep. That's pretty accurate, actually, except replace movies with literally everything.
Well, that's a line from 2001's Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. So
I'm aware.
In 2001, that was pretty accurate. Kevin Smith was predicting our future, Greg.
Yep. Although as a member of the internet wrestling community in 2001, it was true of wrestling as well.
Solid point.
That's all we did was bit. We were in the best era of wrestling ever.
That has ever been, and we just bitched about it.
Yep. That's why we can't have nice things. Speaking of not having nice things, NBC can't have nice things or even bad things because it seems nothing can last on NBC. Mm-hmm. As NBC has removed the short-lived DC comedy Powerless from its schedule for the next
few weeks. Greg Phillips has just torn up the format sheet and thrown it right out the window.
Yes, I have. I've veered off course, but I'm going to get us back on course in just a minute. But I've already mentioned it, so let's talk about Powerless. This is the comedy show that takes place in an office building, a Wayne Industries subsidiary. I watched the first three episodes. First one was bad. Second two were okay. Anyway, it's been removed from the schedule at least for the next 2 weeks, and the status of the show is uncertain. One of the show's executive producers, Patrick Schumacher, tweeted out confirmation of this and also said, Powerless will not air this week or next. This I know for sure. I can guess some other things, but they're not good. Thanks for watching. The ratings have been very bad for Powerless. The reception has been lukewarm from comic book fans. I think people were giving it a chance. And there were some things to enjoy about it. I stopped watching after the third episode, but just an idea that we talked about from the get-go didn't seem to be a winning concept. And while the show might have gotten better, I don't know. I haven't watched any of the recent episodes. Not really a surprise to me that this one failed.
No, not a surprise that anything on NBC ever fails. I mean, that's just not a surprise these days, and I haven't watched any of the show, and probably never, because I just didn't really have any interest in the concept, and yeah, so, oh well.
Now, what will win NBC over for me is if they replace it with a weekly Jim Ross ringside show on NBC.
You are tempting me once again, Greg Phillips, tempting me once more.
Yes, the title of that last little aside there, It Moved.
It Moved.
Speaking of moving, Fox is moving and grooving in the movie business right now. They're with their X-Men lineup. How'd you like that for a segue?
It was certainly natural and unforced in every way.
That's right. The grooving part really put it over the top and made it sound hip. So Fox has announced its Marvel slate of movies. It is going to be a loaded year. The New Mutants officially announced for April 13th, 2018. Then, in June, we've got Deadpool 2, or Deadpool 2, if you will. And the significance of that is it was a movie, the first one, remember, came out in February. This one's coming out in June, which shows you just how successful that movie was. And then finally, they're wrapping 2018 up with Dark Phoenix, the next installment of the X-Men film franchise, on November 2nd. This is a very bold...
aggressive strategy.
Aggressive strategy. You might say it's a bold new direction.
Considering, are any of these movies actually filming yet?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Man, that New Mutants movie is going to have to go into production at warp speed to complete filming. You know, secondary shots, which pretty much every major movie does now. The reshoots mean, and then of course the extensive post production needed for a big budget superhero movie. So.
Yep.
Good luck to Josh Boone, who's going to have to oversee that.
Yeah, writing and directing it. Josh Boone is New Mutants. This just adds to a loaded slate for comic book fans in 2018, Nick. This is going to be probably I'd have to research this to be sure of it, to actually look back on what we've had, but it may be the most loaded year yet for at least superhero comic book films.
Yeah, I can think off the top of my head, the Avengers Infinity War, Aquaman, I believe, is also next year, or Aquaman, if you will.
Yes.
These three Fox movies we just talked about. Black Panther, I believe, is next year. Oh, what's the November next year film for Marvel? They have three. They have Avengers, they have Black Panther, and they have...
Doctor Strange 2?
Doctor Strange 2 is next year?
Maybe. I don't know. I'm asking you.
Oh, no. I would... Maybe Ant-Man and the Wasp? That sounds right.
Yeah. That's probably right.
Yeah. So, and then what else am I missing? Because DC's probably only going to have Aquaman next year, I would imagine. I don't think anything else is far enough along to have a 2018 release date.
Aren't we also getting, let's see, Captain Marvel's 19.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't announced a Captain America sequel yet.
I don't think we're getting a Captain America, not a Captain America sequel with Chris Evans at this point.
Let me see. Yeah, that may be it. I'm not sure. There might be another one or two.
What would be wonderful is we had some sort of tool in front of us, Greg, that would allow us to just have
wonderful. They call him Mr. Wonderful. You know he is so wonderful.
Okay, here we go.
There we go.
Avengers Infinity War. Technically, The Flash is still on schedule for March of next year. Deadpool 2. Gambit is apparently still on the schedule. Ant-Man and the Wasp, The Incredibles 2, The Batman, which is not going to happen, The Sinister Six, which is not going to happen. I think that's it.
Yep. Three X-Men movies. Interesting. Which of these three catches your eye the most?
I'll say New Mutants, just because I'm a little surprised at how long it is. Having it be the first of these is surprising to me. So that's probably the most eye-catching of these announcements. Deadpool 2, though, is easily the most anticipated, in my
opinion. Mm-hmm. I would echo that. We'll see how it all turns out. Dark Phoenix is going to have a lot of expectations since they kind of shat the bed with X-Men 3 doing the Dark Phoenix story. So let's see how they... Let's see how they do with this one and how they recognize the Heck Fire Club.
Does Dark not feel a little soon?
Yes, extremely. Extremely.
Because, I mean, we just got introduced to that version of Jean Grey, and by the end of that film, she was already accessing Phoenix powers that felt a little... I don't know, I feel like there's more character development, more time to build that story, personally.
I agree. We'll see how it all turns out. We'll see how it all turns out. But speaking... of seeing how it all turns out. Let's move to the other biggest news story. And this is pretty late breaking. This was broken on the same day that we were recording this. You talked to Nick about how long that you have been advocating for a DC Rebirth style approach in Marvel. Well, here's something we've been advocating for, both of us, even longer. And that is a DC take on the award-winning concept, Marvel Unlimited. Of course, that is the digital comic book, essentially digital streaming service offered by Marvel for their comics. And it's great. It's wonderful. It's the best investment you can make in comics right now. Here comes Warner Brothers, because Warner Brothers is launching a DC-branded direct-to-consumer digital service in 2018. That's next year, folks, with a new live-action Titans series. And remember we talked about Young Justice Season 3 and we speculated it would be on Netflix? Nope. Young Justice Season 3 is going to be exclusive to the DC digital network.
Right. And I think one thing that's important to point out here is, you know, Greg, you opened this by talking about Marvel Unlimited. That's only a comic service. This new DC thing would appear to be some sort of service that is going to enable DC to push a variety of forms of content to their subscribers. The only two that have been announced thus far are these two shows that we're talking about. No involvement on comic, you know, from the actual print comics has been confirmed, and no involvement from previously established film properties has been confirmed either. But what it would stand to reason that it looks like DC is attempting to kind of bring all their content together in this one digital service.
Right, and not only that, but the Deadline article on this actually said that comics will be included in some way. So we don't know what that entails. We don't know what fan interaction means. We just know that it's going to be a massive undertaking. We also don't know price point.
No, we don't.
Which is potential. But we were discussing this off air today. Ballpark figure, Nick, what would you be willing to pay, assuming that this has both live action, animated, and archival comic book content?
So we are assuming that this is going to have these new original shows and the archives of most of their other filmed content from over the years?
My assumption would be that it wouldn't – I don't think they would roll it out quite as quickly as Marvel Unlimited did. I think that it would probably have a more limited back archive that they would then build upon. Maybe I'm wrong, though. But let's say that it has a limited amount of archived DC comics.
With promises of updating it regularly. You're asking about price point, and there are so many factors that go into that. I mean,
right.
What is the approach to modern material? How soon will modern material be added? What is their approach? If we're going to talk about filmed content, if we're going to talk about television and movies, how extensive is the catalog there? Obviously, you're going to have these two new projects, but what about, just for example, things like Super Friends from the 70s? I mean, is that going to be available on there? How extensive is the library going to be? If it truly is, if the idea is for them to slowly over time add pieces until it truly becomes a one-stop shop for everything DC Entertainment related, then honestly, $25 a month probably, I would pay that.
A lot of money.
A lot of money, but I mean, think about it. Marvel Unlimited right now is running about $9.99 a month. You throw in the DC Comics archives, which in theory should be more extensive than the Marvel Comics archives, given the extended publishing history of a lot of these characters. You add in the functionality to continue to roll out new content every 6 months or so, depending on how long you want the delay to be. Add in original television content that, quite frankly, Marvel Unlimited does not have, and the entire backlog of DC movies and television shows from across the decades, which is a more extensive list of content than that of Marvel. Yeah, I don't think that's unreasonable.
All right. Personally. What if they do the service and they have it be booked by Bill Watts?
I don't know. That's just more money out of my pocket, Greg, quite frankly.
I am really interested to see what this turns into, and I'd be willing to fork out a lot of money. We'd have to see. Again, a lot of it is we have to wait and see what we're going to be offered here, but I certainly would be willing to pay for it. And I think what separates us from a lot of folks, Nick, is our primary interest in the comic side would be for the archive material as opposed to the new stuff. I like grabbing physical comics and reading them, and I like supporting the local comic shops when I can, and also creators and stuff. So I feel like, from our end anyway, we're going to be keeping our eyes on just what kind of archival material is going to be available, and is it going to be stuff that hasn't been readily accessible to this point?
Well, I don't even necessarily care about whether it's commonly reprinted stuff. The fact is, if I can get it all for one price a month, as opposed to having to buy these individual, trades or whatnot, I'm certainly going to be more willing to go that direction. I love having trades. I love collecting trades, but I don't actually pull them out and reread them that often. So having an opportunity to have thousands of issues at my fingertips at any given moment is certainly appealing.
But I think that in particular there's value for runs that are unlikely to be reprinted because the audience may not be there.
True.
Something like, I'm trying to think of an example.
Steve like Englehart's Green Lantern Corps.
Yes, Englehart's Green Lantern Corps, or the New Guardians book that we were talking about possibly.
Well, let's not, we may have future installments, Greg. Let's not tell tales out of skew.
But certainly if they put that on that DC service, it would make it much easier to access. So,
yes, I mean, in theory,
legally,
depending on how it all works out and how the tech support is for it and what the backlog really is, this has the potential to be the fullest realization of what Marvel Unlimited is right now. Like, take it to another level by adding in the video content. This is extremely exciting, and it's just, it now DC, they've got a year to plan it and get it right, and make it so that these people who jump on in the first few months want to stay on, because a lot of these people, if you get them on for a free trial or what have you, and they leave because they're dissatisfied with the lack of content or the content that is there, they're probably not going to come back. So you've got to make this launch successful out of the gate.
Gotcha. Yeah, I agree. I'm very excited about this. We'll see where it goes and see what, if anything, Marvel does. You know, the other thing is this might force Marvel to kind of add some stuff to Marvel Unlimited from what it currently is, which, as it is awesome. Again, highly recommend anybody out there to check out Marvel Unlimited, because it's truly an unprecedented resource for comic book fans. But let's move on to the printed page, speaking of DC, and let's talk about this Dark Matter, or the Dark Days event.
Dark Matter is actually what we're talking about.
Yes. But out of that, Dark Knight Metal event, I should say, we'll spin again, we're getting into the idiotic buzzwords of the comic book industry, but under the banner, which Dan Didio makes it very clear in a quote, that this is not an imprint, this is not a world, this is not a universe. Dark Matter is a banner.
It's a banner. And
under the banner of Dark Matter-cal, they will be launching a series of 6 brand new titles that will launch out of this summer event by Greg Capullo and Scott Snyder. And the concept of this is multifold, reading between the lines. What they've talked about being the concept is bringing the artist back to the forefront and focusing on the artists being marketed and promoted right alongside the writers, and truly having more of a team approach to the comic creation process. What that means, I don't know. You would think they were already doing that, but that's how they're marketing it, as the artists are coming back to the forefront. And it's been a while since the artists have taken the forefront, so I get it. And the other thing is perhaps creating some genuinely new and diverse characters that there haven't been enough of in a long time. There are also some relaunches in here, too, and some characters with names similar to existing characters. So, books that will spin out of Dark Knight's Metal are Sideways by writers Dan Didio and Justin Jordan, and artist Kenneth Rocafort, that will follow the events of a teleporting teenager changed by Dark Knight's Metal. You've also got The Silencer by Dan Abnett and John Romita Jr., and it will focus on, brace yourself for this name, Honor Guest, the former world's deadliest assassin, now trying for a quiet life in the suburbs until her former life comes back to haunt her and she must become the silencer to protect her family. Immortal Men by James Tynion IV and artist Jim Lee, you may have heard of him. A story about 5 immortal siblings who operate from the shadows, recruiting the elite against the foes who seek to bring about Armageddon. Which sounds like a voiceover from a 1999 WWF pay-per-view. Damage, a longtime title of it, or name for a DC character, but this is going to be a different take, a different character entirely.
Oh, Damage. This is going to be Damage.
Damage by Mean Gene Okerlund.
Oh, artist I might actually buy that. I will talk about that in a minute.
Damage by writer Robert Venditti and artist Tony S. Daniel, in which Army recruit Ethan Avery is granted the power to unleash an unstoppable monster for 1 hour at a time. And finally, we've got, let me make sure this is finally, this is not finally.
um,
computer is freezing up. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, finally, I mentioned six. One of those is including Metal, which is the event by Snyder and Capullo that will launch it all. And finally, the that we haven't talked about is New Challengers by Scott Snyder and artist Andy Kubert. And it is a reboot of Challengers of the Unknown with a new cast and a new mission. There's a lot to unpack here, and we're already going long on the rundown. But just on its face, let's talk about the titles, and then, you know, maybe we'll get into the deeper discussion here after that. But looking at these titles, what do you make of this announcement? What do you make of the announcement, and what do you make of these launches? Any of them appeal to you?
It's a weird announcement. It certainly seems strange to be promising for the second time in just under 2 years, Jim Lee on monthly art, even though we all know that's never going to happen. It's also, though, I think it's a legitimate complaint about Rebirth is that with the twice monthly publishing schedule and the rotating artist, it makes it feel as if the artist is secondary in the creative process. So I like that aspect of it. And I like the idea of making truly A-list creative teams and putting them on new characters. But I got to be honest, a lot of these pitches just don't do much for me. Silencer sounds somewhat intriguing to me, and I'm intrigued by New Challengers just because of Scott Snyder. But other than that, the other four are the other three, I should say, not counting Metal, because I think Metal is just... We'll talk about why I think Metal is included on this list in a little bit, but the other three just don't do much for me, honestly.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I think looking at all of these, first of all, Sideways, I'm not interested in at all. Not just because Dan Didio is attached to it, because he actually has written some pretty good comics over the years in co-writing roles. Anyway, I don't like Kenneth Rocafort's art. I've never been shy about saying that, and the pitch doesn't sound at all intriguing. Silencer, like you, it's the one that, of all the pitches, Silencer is probably the one that sounds the coolest to me. Granted, it sounds like it's been done before, but to me it sounds a little bit like if you gave Hit Girl from Kick-Ass her own comic book in the DCU, which is kind of... the name Honor Guest, I really hope that they take the time to consider that name and perhaps come up with a different one. Immortal Men, I'm probably going to, at the very least, check out and trade for them because of Jim Lee art, if it actually happens, you know. But again, it's such a vague pitch that it's hard to tell what it even means, you know. Five immortal siblings who operate from the shadows, it's very Image, early 90s, you know?
Yep.
Which, you know, it could be good. The art, I'm sure, will be great, but we'll see how that turns out. Damage does sound interesting to me. So I'd say Damage and the Silencer are the two that stand out in terms of pitches that are intriguing. New Challengers, I don't know what the hell it means because I've never read Challengers of the Unknown. So I don't know what any of it means. It's very vague, but the creative team... All right, you got my attention. And again, these are A-list creative teams, by and large. But yeah, I'm like you, Nick. I don't have money. I don't have the money to buy all the Rebirth books that I want right now. Now you're giving me another initiative with another banner across the top of the cover that you want me to buy. And it's like, I would love to, but I just don't have the disposable income to take chances on all these books, you know? It's frustrating to a point, and I do think to your point earlier, with twice monthly diluting the art on some of these Rebirth books, who's left now to be consistent artists on these Rebirth books? You're really digging into your well of talented A-list artists anyway, and it's also it feels like there's getting to be a bit of a shall we say a surplus of titles now. When you add these five ongoings to the list of ongoings from DC. So I don't know. It's concerning, but not concerning, that's the wrong word for it, but it's just kind of like you, I'm not really sucked in by this at all.
Hey,
but
let me ask you this then. How successful do you think this will be, and how long do you think it will take before all of these books are canceled?
I'm glad you asked that.
What do you think will be the last book standing, I suppose?
The last book standing will be New Challengers, because it's an existing property and Scott Snyder is on it as a writer.
Yep. I would agree.
If Jim Lee were to be consistent with his art, Immortal Men could still be standing.
There is no, like, we've been down this road how many times in recent years, Greg?
I know. It's not
going to happen. I have moved past, like, the idea of entertaining the hypothetical fantasy comics draft scenario of, well, imagine what it would happen if Jim Lee produced a book every month. It is as unrealistic as me winning the lottery. Like, I guess.
Or as Kevin Smith writing a monthly comic.
Or as Kevin Smith writing. That's exactly right. Why don't Jim Lee and Kevin Smith just do a book together? Because then at least their publishing schedules would be synced up for the most part. You know,
right.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah, I would say that. Barring that, the New Challengers will be the last one standing. But here's why there is interest for me in this project, even if I'm not going to buy any of the titles. Okay. There's a couple of different areas to go with it. I'm not sure which one I want to focus on, because we don't have time to do both. But
we got time. It's our fucking show. Do whatever you want. We're the masters of our own destinies.
Are we?
Hmm. We are. And right now, we're about to talk about the bullshit politics in the back.
We're about to. But before we get to that, there's... okay, so... the desire to have new, original characters that are popular and that last... is understandable to me, because we've talked about this before, and I think we came up with Harley Quinn as the last new original character that really lasted, that wasn't a Robin or an existing legacy character of some kind.
Okay, so you're not going to count legacy characters as part of that. Okay, I was wondering what's your criteria.
No, I don't.
Some would say like Miles Morales, but you're saying not.
I'm saying a new original, completely original character, and even Harley Quinn you could tie into the Joker.
Right, right.
So the last new original character who wasn't inherently tied to another character was that took off in popularity, at least from DC, was what? Lobo,
I would suppose, yeah.
You know, and that's going back to, you know, the late 80s, mid to late 80s. Actually, he was created in 83, I think, but he really took off in the late 80s.
Right.
So we're going, the point being, we're going on 20 years at this point. Even if we count Harley, we're going on 20 years without a significant original creation that really lasts in DC that isn't tied inherently to an existing character. Now, some people out there would say, well, what's the big deal with that? And I get that. Hey, we can have 1,000 Robins and 1,000 Flashes and whatever. But there is no getting around the fact that if you compare Wonder Woman to Supergirl, and this is no offense to Supergirl fans. I like Supergirl. I love the show. I love the character. I love Kara. She's great. But when you compare Wonder Woman to Supergirl, Wonder Woman is a better character. And why is Wonder Woman a better character? Because Wonder Woman is defined by Wonder Woman. She is her own person. No matter how you slice it, I'm sorry, the harsh reality, Supergirl's always going to be Superman's cousin. That's who she is. She-Hulk is always going to be the Hulk's cousin. New original characters have value because they are defined by no one but themselves. And I think this initiative, I applaud it for trying to create new characters and promote them. The issue that we're going to run into is this, Nick. This is going to settle a long-standing debate in the comic book community and a long-standing question I've had in my own mind about comic books and the business of comic books in 2017, because there's a thought process that modern comic book fans value creators over characters in general. And that's why when you see, and it's inarguable that when you see Geoff Johns go to a book, the sales increase. Scott Snyder, sales increase. Jason Aaron, sales increase. And likewise for the prominent artists, Jim Lee, et cetera, mostly 90s artists. But this is going to put that to the test, because I think the success of these books, by and large, is going to tell you whether in 2017 the value is with predominantly with the character or with the creator. Because these are A-list creative teams.
I actually don't agree with that.
And tell me why.
Let me tell you why. We say A-list creative teams, but is Robert Venditti really an A-list creator?
No, but Tony Daniel is, I think.
Is James Tynion IV really an A-list creator?
No, but Jim Lee is the A-list creator.
I agree. What you're talking about, you said A-list creative teams. And I think...
Well, come on now. I mean, how many A-list creative teams could you possibly create?
That is,
you've got
and that's
two A-list writers is, and two A-list... And you know, but what I'm saying is John Romita Jr. is an A-list artist in terms of star power.
Yeah. Well,
regardless of my thoughts on his style. Jim Lee... Yeah.
My point is that the idea of the true A-list creative team, I think we talk about it as if it's like, oh, there are just A-list creative teams to be had out there, and there really aren't, is my point. Like,
no, but what I'm saying is, when I say – let me be more specific then. Creators,
okay.
A-list creators, because it's unrealistic to expect both the writer and the artist to have huge name values in comics. It doesn't happen. Rarely, anyway. Scott Snyder and Andy Kubert would be an A-list creative team.
Absolutely. That one I will grant you, certainly.
Tony Daniel, I would consider to be, at the very least, a B-list star power artist. Jim Lee is an A-list star power artist. Romita Jr. is an A-list star power artist. Obviously, Sideways doesn't fit that bill. But I think that what we'll see is, are people going to buy Immortal Men because Jim Lee is attached? Are people going to buy New Challengers because Scott Snyder and Andy Kubert are attached? Those are the two that I think, to your point, are going to be interesting to watch. Obviously, all these books are going to sell well out of the gates because they'll be number ones. But will the sales be there to support them long term? And
that's the question I have about these characters and these books' viability long term. Can you really I'm trying to think how I want to put this. Can you really throw all of these new books and all of these new characters and concepts out there at one time and not be diluting the marketplace a little bit? I think what I'm driving at is, if you really want to get a new character over or a new title over, wouldn't you want the focus to be on that particular character or that particular title rather than trying to do five of them at once? I think there is the potential for some of these. Like, let me go back and look at the list to pick one out, you know, an actual example. But I think there is the potential for a book like, let's say, Damage, a perfect example, Damage. Robert Venditti and Tony Daniel. I think of the books that I'm looking at right now, that's the one that has neither an A-list artist nor an A-list writer or Dan Didio writing it. You see what I'm saying? Like, it's the one of the five. I guess my point is, if a book like Damage doesn't do well, I don't think you can say that settles the argument of character versus creator in terms of sales in 2017.
Right.
Because you have the extenuating circumstance of potentially it getting lost in the shuffle.
No, that's a good point. It's a good point. I think that when you look at New Challengers in particular and also Immortal Men, again, that's with the Jim Lee caveat, or even The Silencer for Romita Jr., I think there is something to be said for that, because I would like to think that creators have more cachet in 2016 than they ever have before. But, you know, and obviously there's going to be exceptions. Nothing's going to sell as well as Batman. We know that. Nothing's going to sell as well as Justice League. We know that. But when you're looking at more of those ancillary titles, you know, and also what's going to happen to the rotations on the existing Rebirth books. So, you know,
well,
there's
a lot of these guys weren't in rotation anyway, so that's
true.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
In terms of the artists anyway, the writers I'm assuming will be able to
balance it
as they have for quite some time. But here's the part where I have to reveal something of a little bit of a dirty truth for me when it comes to this. And it's going to be related, I think, to a story you're going to want to talk about here in just a second. I'm not saying I'm pulling for it to fail. I am saying I am not going to be broken up if it doesn't do well.
And let's get into that, because this week there were some pretty major, or at least for me, pretty surprising news stories that came out. Not surprising in that there were elements of it that I knew, that we knew about, but surprising in terms of the level of detail and the level of depth at something of a civil war of sorts going on.
I am sorry, Greg. I am sorry to good Lord. Nick Duke just had him a little fangasm right here in the, not comics related. So I'll resist, or should I say it?
Go ahead and say it.
Jeff Goldblum coming back to the Jurassic Park franchise.
Oh, wow.
Yes. I'll have some. Anyway, moving on.
There's a, that is to say, civil war within
okay, Mr. Goldblum, thanks for your contribution.
There is a civil war of sorts within the DC Comics front office. This is all according to Rich Johnston of Bleeding Cool. Take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, consider the source on this one.
Whether you choose to believe Rich or not, he has been right about things. He's been wrong about things.
Oh, does this mean we've reached our Russell Sellers' favorite part of our podcast?
That's right.
Baseless speculation and rumor?
That's right. Baseless speculation and rumor. Rich does, though, have a history of, at the very least, uncovering.
Yeah, this comes from Rich at Bleeding Cool. This is not a Jude Terror sarcasm influenced and ultra hilarious piece on the state of comics.
Right. So according to this piece by Bleeding Cool, Rich Johnston, there's actually two of them. Mm-hmm. They're kind of tied together. One of them is just a bunch of spoilers about what's coming up with doing away with the New 52 timeline. But the main one we want to talk about is the story that there is a divide at DC between Dan DiDio, who is the co-publisher of DC Comics, and Jeff Johns, who was recently promoted to DC Comics president alongside Diane Nelson. Well, different president. But this divide goes back a very long time, all the way back to the birth of the New 52. Apparently, and we've known this for quite some time, Dan and Jeff have vastly different outlooks on the DC universe. You see, before the New 52 started, it was originally going to be Justice League Rebirth. This is a story that was going to bring the Big Seven back to the title Justice League. And the concept of it was that. So Jeff and Jim Lee were going to work on it, and they were going to tell the story that eventually became Justice League Volume 2, which was the David Graves story, if you remember that one. Well, as they're in the brainstorming stages of this, Dan really pushes for the New 52. Restart the entire universe from scratch. This was in opposition to Jeff's philosophy, which was to build upon what already existed and update it accordingly. So since the New 52 is happening, Jeff Johns says, hell, I want to get in on the ground floor. So he hastily threw together the Darkseid story that kicked off the New 52 with Justice League Origin. Well, along with all that came the 5-year timeline and all the stuff we've been over that didn't work in the New 52. Fast forward a few years, and you can tell, according to this, which books were, quote, Dan books and which books were Jeff books. Something like Green Lantern managed to avoid having its continuity rebooted. things like Aquaman would often ignore the rules that were put into place by Dan DiDio, such as no marriages, things of that nature, by basically just ignoring them. And in between the two continents of DiDio and Johns, Scott Snyder carved out his Batman corner. So, with DC Rebirth, this was a Geoff Johns taking back the reins event. He leveraged his DC presidential role, worked with the creators to define what Rebirth would be, as well as developing this Watchmen-related mystery, and brought back many of the attributes that Dan DiDio had pushed to do away with. And we're seeing that currently play out in the pages of books like Superman, Batman, and Blue Beetle, where we're seeing the New 52 continuity gradually either erased or blended with what took place before, and we're seeing the classic iterations of these heroes come back to the forefront. Along with financial success, which New 52 also had at the beginning, Rebirth also enjoyed critical acclaim. Dan DiDio went off to focus his time on the Hanna-Barbera properties.
Which I had never known until this report that that was largely a DiDio joint. But now knowing that, it makes a lot of sense. Like, really
right.
off-kilter takes on these characters that is somewhat unique when compared to their classic iterations.
Right. And they're doing fairly well. So, but now DiDio, apparently, according to Rich, decided he wanted to reinstitute himself into the DC universe, and that's where the Dark Matter arc, the Dark Matter line, came from.
Banner. The Dark Matter banner.
Banner. It's a banner. It's not a universe. It's a banner.
Rich, I swear to God, Rich,
it never happened.
Never happened, bro.
So, this is a Dan DiDio joint. Rebirth was a Geoff Johns joint. Metal is a Dan DiDio joint.
No. Dark Matter is a
Dark Matter, sorry. Yes. So,
let us take care to even though, and wait, well, I'll get there. Go ahead.
So, anyway, apparently Geoff Johns is annoyed that a no. Greg Capullo and Jim Lee. And also, as evidence for this, Rich points to the fact that Geoff Johns has not retweeted any of the announcements regarding Metal or Dark Matter, although he did post a plug for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Now, to be fair, at the end of 2016, he did have, like, a series of tweets. It was, like, five things I'm excited for in 2017, and one of those was Snyder and Capullo's Batman story. So, not recently, but he has supported that particular project in the past.
Right. No mention of Dark Matter, nothing since this announcement. And I wonder if it's one of those deals, like the New 52, that started as one thing, perhaps a self-contained Batman event, and then ballooned into something else entirely. Mm-hmm. So, Nick, what do you make of all this? What does it mean? What does it all mean, Basil?
I don't know what it all means because I can't say for sure that any of it is true. But based on interviews that the two have given over the last decade, basically...
It rings true, doesn't it?
It rings true. It sounds a lot like that Dan and Geoff just have two different ideas on what the DC Universe could and should be in the modern context. And personally, I find myself identifying almost entirely with that vision that is put forth by Geoff Johns,
yeah,
as opposed to the one that is put forth by Danny D, as he is so lovingly known on this show. And that is why I think... For the purposes of this discussion, Greg, let's assume that the Bleeding Cool article is true. That all of it's true.
Yep.
That it's true, all of it. In Han
it's
Solo,
true. All of it. I knew it.
In Han Solo's speech. If all of this is true, here's what I think is happening. I think Metal was already pre-planned, and we've known that for a long time it was pre-planned between Snyder and Capullo to come in.
Mm-hmm.
I think DiDio built these other five titles, pulled in Metal because he knows that that's like an A-list creative team, and he knows that the artist is working on the forefront to kind of sell his pitch line of bringing artists back to the forefront, and so that inevitably, down the road, when some of these books start to fail in terms of sales and critical acclaim, he can point to Metal as buoying the overall banner. You see what I'm saying? To even out the low points. I think the only reason Metal is being looped into this is to save face for Dan DiDio. And that is why, as I alluded to earlier, I'm not pulling for any of these books to fail. All these creators deserve to make money, and I hope that we genuinely get some long-term characters out of it for the DC Universe. But if this could somehow be the last great gasp of Dan DiDio in terms of overwhelming amounts of influence at DC Comics, don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out, as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. No, I'm with you. And this is almost confirmation of what we have kind of felt as fans reading interviews and reading a little bit between the lines, which you kind of have to do sometimes in comics the same way you kind of have to do in wrestling. You kind of have to read between the lines a little bit in a lot of these quote-unquote out-of-character interviews. And like you, I'm in Camp Geoff Johns. You know, I think DiDio's approach has apparently worked for people that are buying those Hanna-Barbera comics, but his approach to DC since he's been in charge has seemingly been wildly fluctuating, first of all, and second of all, almost a combative attitude towards his strongest creators at times. And
almost a combative attitude towards certain characters and concepts. Like,
right.
Things that he's just made up his mind that he hates and wants to get rid of. And I would suggest that, couldn't it be said that the success of the Hanna-Barbera line might have to do largely with the fact that he can screw with continuity because there is no real continuity to most of the Hanna-Barbera properties.
Exactly.
In terms of
exactly.
Meaningful story continuity, and that most of the people who are probably reading the Hanna-Barbera characters don't have a history and a love for the characters the same way they do for their DC counterparts.
You said it perfect, Bubba. It's a different animal. It is a different animal. No getting around it. And when you hear that a guy that is running a company seems to have such open enmity for certain characters, it makes you wonder if he's running the wrong company. but that's neither here
and
nor there.
That's one thing he has openly said. He was always a Marvel guy growing up, and he thought a lot of the DC characters and concepts were lame. He preferred Marvel. Always had.
Yep. Curious, eh?
Indeed.
But with that being said, we're going to mercifully bring the rundown to an end. That went way long, but there's just a lot going on. And I think this was one of our more interesting philosophical comic discussions, Nick. What do you think?
I agree. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun. And, you know, where do you guys fall? You guys agree with Nick, with me, with both of us, with neither of us? Are we idiots? Are we stuck in the wool? Are we ruining comics for everyone?
Are there any
the problem?
Are there any Dan DiDio fanboys out there? Are those real things that exist?
Maybe. Please let us know. Drop us a line on Twitter. I'm at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. Email gregp@placetobenation.com. My current inbox is filled with spam, so I invite legitimate emails only. nickd@placetobenation.com. And, of course, on Facebook, the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, let us know your thoughts on these big news stories, the battle within DC's offices, the Metal and Dark Matter event, the Marvel Legacy, all of this stuff. Let us know your thoughts on the state of the comic book industry. Now, that brings an end to the rundown. That means it's time for our weekly segment where we talk about all the things that we have enjoyed in comic book media the last week or so. That, of course, is...
Oh,
my God.
Wow.
Indeed. Ho Ho Loon, in fact. Let's see what this thing has to say. Well, let's see here. MacGyver canceled. And Tom Selleck still on the air. Paul Hogan filming Crocodile Dundee 4. Up! Oh! Ho Ho Loon, still employed by World Wrestling Entertainment.
And still in the WrestleMania 33 program.
Wow. Folks, these are news updates you can't get on any other podcast.
None.
Except the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. And with that being said, folks, it is time for your favorite weekly segment and ours. So, Nick, what you been watching? I haven't been watching a damn thing.
Me neither.
Moving on. What you been reading, Nick? I haven't been reading a damn thing except Green Lantern, Green Arrow by Denny O'Neill, or Dennis O'Neill, and Neil Adams. What about you, Nick?
At some point, you'll actually have books again. I don't know when that will happen. But I suppose I'll go into my reading and watching. And because I'm doing it by myself, I'll take whatever format I damned well please, quite frankly. And with that being said, my bottom book of the week, so I'm going to start there. I'm going Superman 21, an exceptionally strong week of comics this week. Nothing really bad to say about it. Just a book had to be at the bottom, and this was just a great week of comics, in my opinion. So Superman 21, no real criticisms, but it's at the bottom for me. Moving on to my top three books, I'll go at number three. I have got Trinity number 8. This is written by Cullen Bunn with art from... Oh, boy. Art from Lupacino? Question mark?
Sure, we'll go with that.
We'll go with that. In any event, this was a really, really good issue of Trinity that is tagged as a aftermath issue from Superman Reborn. It deals a lot with the shared history of Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman, and kind of what their status quo and the relationship between the three characters has been to this point, but it also introduces a very interesting concept, Greg. At the end, Superman shares the information with Batman and Wonder Woman about Mr. Oz and how he's kind of been interacting with Superman for the last several months and how he feels like he has some sort of unstated influence over the events over Superman's life and how he may be involved in the manipulation of Superman's timeline. Well, Batman then shares information about, you know, the button that they've been working on, and Wonder Woman talks about how some of her past has also been screwed up lately. And the three come to the realization that there's an extremely large force at work that is manipulating the very fabric of time and existence. And they choose, because they know so little and don't want to scare anyone or spread misinformation, they choose to keep that information to themselves rather than sharing it with the rest of the Justice League. In Ascension, setting up something of a shadow Justice League within the Justice League. And I think there is a lot of potential in this concept. What happens when the rest of the League finds out that information was being withheld from them? What happens to the rest of the DC Universe when they find out that Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman have kind of taken it upon themselves to formalize the Trinity, in a way, manner of speaking, as a group that is above the rest of the heroic community? I think this is a really intriguing concept, and I am all on board if this is the idea that's going to be explored in Trinity going forward. So, Trinity number 3.
Yeah.
Trinity number 8 is my number 3 book of the week.
Very interesting concept, and the ramifications are interesting. And there's also theories out there that there are multiple Batmen. Have you seen those theories, that there are currently two Batmen, one person pretending to be Batman and the real Batman?
No, I haven't seen that.
There is a theory by some that I don't necessarily into, but that Night Owl is actually one of the Batmen that we're seeing in, for instance, in Justice League of America. I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's fun to think about. And also fun to think about the theory that, you know, this is all going to blow up when the Justice League finds out that the Trinity is keeping stuff from them. So
absolutely.
Quite interesting. And let me ask you this. Is Manipul off that book, or what's the deal?
I believe that is the case, at least going forward. But Cullen Bunn did a hell of a job this week. So don't know what the deal with Manipul is. Always knew that asking him to write and draw a monthly simultaneously was going to be a tough ask. But we will see. I'm not really sure what the status quo of that one is. Moving on to my number 2 book of the week. And this is going to come as something of a surprise to some people. It may be a somewhat controversial, somewhat unique pick for my number 2 book, and I'm going to throw this one out as a special dedication to one Kelly Puhle, because I am going at number 2 with Secret Empire number 0. I really enjoyed this. I thought it was really good. I have a great attachment to Steve Rogers. I have never been a Captain America fan, so the idea of Captain America as a Hydra sleeper agent has never bothered me. Especially when you consider it's just another comic book storyline. It's just another example of, ultimately, you can use all the terms about the cosmic cube and reality warping and all that stuff, but it's essentially a souped-up version of a brainwashing story where eventually Cap is going to realize what has been done to him, and he's going to have another reason to go after Hydra with a vengeance, and it just adds another angle to that decades-long Captain America versus Hydra dynamic. And this one, I gotta say, man, it was just really entertaining and well done. It was well written by Nick Spencer. It has some intriguing takes on the story and angles to the story that I was not expecting. It isn't nearly as straightforward, or at least let me say this. I don't want to spoil too much, but Cap's understanding of his past and the role he is attempting to fill in the Marvel Universe is not as straightforward as a lot of us who have been reading Marvel regularly had been led to believe. There's a little bit more going on here than just Cap believes Marvel, or Cap believes Hydra is the best solution for the world. There's a different angle to it that I don't want to spoil. And so, I'm in on this concept. I'm in on this book. And Greg, it's very similar to a pitch that you and I have had out there for a hypothetical Superman story for a long time. So I'm all in on this, man. I'm enjoying it. And this was just a very well-written kickoff that kind of sets the groundwork for the Secret Empire event to come. The one drawback I'll say is the art from Daniel Acuna was not fantastic, but I thought Nick Spencer's writing made up for it in terms of the tight plotting.
Very interesting. I'm sure we'll get some feedback on that. I will say that I have long been, as you know, Nick, from the minute they did it, I had no issues with the evil Cap story. I think in light of recent events and in light of the direction that I was informed that the story has taken, and that it kind of revolves around a Cap thinks that the Allies winning the war was what caused reality to change to be like it is, I guess. But mm-hmm. It kind of paints it in a little bit different light from what I was originally imagining, and I kind of get where people are coming from on it, because it seems as if they've made Captain America at the very least complicit in trying to help the Nazis win World War II, which you get into kind of dicey territory when you involve real life stuff like that, and I kind of get why people are upset about it.
I don't. I'm
up too much with it.
The story has been presented to us as Captain America's own perception of reality has been warped and altered. And I think, again, this is not a long-term change. This is not something that is going to fundamentally alter who Steve Rogers is and will be coming out on the other side of us. Especially since we know Marvel Legacy is coming, that is going to refocus characters back to their core elements. So, it's a temporary thing, and I don't think there's a need to get all bent out of shape about it, personally.
Right. I get that. I don't know. I've read some things about it that have kind of changed my perception a little bit, because the Holocaust is pretty much the most serious event you could possibly invoke. And right. I think some people, no matter what you do, no matter if you bring Steve Rogers, or you reveal that he was just brainwashed the entire time, as we've suspected from the beginning, or whatever you want to talk about it, it's hard to recoup from. You can't redeem yourself from the Holocaust. You know what I mean? Like somebody, and what put it in this light to me, Nick? Somebody tweeted out that scene from Preacher. You know, the one where he meets the guy that he thought was his friend, that was his neighbor, who he finds out was a Nazi war criminal. And he leaves him with the rope because he said there's some things you can't atone for.
I suppose, but I mean, to me, you know, it's just another comic book story. Like, I think at the end of the day, you're going to reset this, and you're going to have Steve Rogers realize that he's been taken advantage of and that he was the real victim in all of this. I don't see the harm in it personally, but to each their own.
Right. I mean, and like, I don't have a personal attachment to the comic book character Captain America either, per se. And so I get that. But I'm just saying, some people could say to you, why'd you get so upset about Grant Morrison's Batman? You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, just get over it. So, you know, it's... I think there are legitimate concerns to be had with it. But it's just an interesting situation. Like, I don't know. I'm kind of two minds about it, because I think that you need to do stories of this ilk once in a while, to freshen things up and to give us new perspectives. And like you said, like we said from the get-go in the very first issue or episode we did on it, to add a new wrinkle to a story that's been told over and over again for 70 years, which is Captain America versus the Red Skull, right?
Captain America versus Hydra in the larger sense. Yes, here.
Right. Which begs another question, Nick. What is the status of the Red Skull right now? Is he around? Does he exist?
Okay, now granted, you remember, I haven't been reading a lot of the books that have led up to this. I really only picked up the event title. My understanding is that even within Hydra, so technically Cap is a part of Hydra and the Red Skull is the head of Hydra. The issue is that Cap and the Red Skull, even though they are both Hydra, are at odds over the direction that Hydra should take and its role in shaping the world. And so you still maintain a little bit of that Cap versus Red Skull dynamic, and now you have the Red Skull, again, based on my understanding, questioning his entire plan, because now he realizes that even though potentially Captain America's reality and perception of reality is being rewritten, that inadvertently the Skull can't escape the idea that no matter what he does, Steve Rogers is always going to bring down Hydra in the end. That now Steve Rogers is warping Hydra into something the Red Skull doesn't want it to be. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. Okay, cool. What's your number one?
Okay, and finally, moving on to my number one, I got Green Arrow 21. This is the first part of the Rise of Star City storyline. I love this, man. It's like, it's laid out in an interesting fashion where each page is almost presented like a splash page with three different storylines or subplots running simultaneously. So you got, like, one subplot will run all the way across both pages from left to right, another subplot will run all the way across both pages from left to right, and the third subplot will run all the way across both pages from left to right. But it's a really intriguing concept, and it's bringing together a lot of the characters and ideas from the entire, like, 20-issue Green Arrow run to this point, and feels like it's really building towards something of a culmination for this title. And it's seeking to answer the question of how both Star City and Seattle can coexist in Green Arrow's history and in the current DC universe. So really, really dug this one.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, let's get on to your quick hits.
And finally,
quick hits. Yeah.
And finally, quick hits. First of all, the first book I've read under the new DC Digital Code Initiative, Batwoman number 2. Absolutely outstanding. Just missed my top 3. Art is great from Steve Epting. The writing is great from Marguerite Bennett. This is a title that everybody needs to be looking out for. Batwoman is bouncing onto my radar between her solo title and Detective Comics. She's hopped onto my radar in a big bad way over the last year or so. So big props to Batwoman number 2. Moving on, Aquaman 21 continues the H2.0 storyline and continues to bring a really horror-type approach to Aquaman. Aquaman is the title that's kind of been just a great hodgepodge of different... Hodgepodge. Great
Is it a Danny Hodgepodge?
A great Danny Hodgepodge of different ideas and different subgenres over the last year. Political stories, war stories, and now a horror story. And I enjoyed the hell out of it. Green Lanterns 21 brings a close to the current Dr. Polaris storyline polarity, while also keeping the villain on the table and promising big bad things for him to come in the near future. Batman 21, this is the first part of the Button crossover. I enjoyed it. Had a really cool sequence where a large portion of the book takes place over the course of just 1 minute and features a fight between Batman and the Reverse Flash, and it's very well done, although it was a little light on actual Button investigation, as was promised in the solicit. But I'm hopeful that Flash 21 this week can right that ship a little bit. And finally, All-Star Batman number 9 brings an end to the Ends of the Earth storyline by revealing the ultimate mastermind behind it. It's a pretty good little take. The book is very well written, some great jock art, and moments to shine for supporting Batman characters, such as Catwoman, Alfred, and Duke Thomas. So, love the hell out of this one as well. A fantastic week for comics across the board, I must say.
Excellent. Excellent work, good sir. Thank you for carrying my fat ass to another finish line of reading and watching. You been playing the DC Legends game?
Yes, but we don't really have time to talk about it tonight. I have been playing it, though.
All right, well, let's go to the break, and when we come back, we promise we will finally talk about Green Lantern and Green Arrow by Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams. Stay with us right through the break.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows, plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's blog, of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuestas podcast, The Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Road tripping with my two favorite allies. Pulling loaded, we got snacks and supplies. It's time to leave this town, it's time to steal away. Let's go get lost anywhere in the USA. Let's go get lost, let's go get lost. Blue, you sit so pretty west of the one. Sparkle like with yellow icing, just a mirror for the sun. Just a mirror for the sun. Just a mirror for the sun.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We are here today for a long book hunt, and it's finally time. After that long rundown, after the reading and watching, it's finally time.
Of which there was no watching.
That's right. It's finally time for us to talk about the Hard Traveling Heroes. The Hard Traveling Fanboys talking about the Hard Traveling Heroes, Green Lantern, featuring Green Arrow, by Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams. Nick, pretty excited to delve into this one.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's... Although we have ourselves a little bit of credit, Greg, because I think there have been a few low-hanging fruits that have been out there since the beginning of our association with Place to Be Nation, going all the way back to the Column days. And I think we should be commended for not reaching for the low-hanging fruit of doing a hard-traveling fanboys on the hard-traveling heroes for almost 4 years. I think we deserve a little credit for that.
Personally, I think we should get some sort of award or placard honoring us for doing that.
Or some sort of financial compensation.
Hey, that'd be great, too. A little quick aside here, by the way, folks. Just today, on the day of this podcast, I was giving a speech at a local advertising federation, and they, at the end of the speech, they handed me a very nice award in a box, a gift for coming and agreeing to speak to their club. And this was a nice little plaque that they had given me. And I realized later in the day, once I had returned to my apartment and finished several meetings, and I thought to myself, hey, I need to get that plaque and put it up somewhere. And then I realized, wait a minute, the plaque's not here. Only to remember that I had left the plaque on the table where I had eaten lunch after getting... Mm-hmm. I'm probably going to forget about it and not actually get to display it anywhere. So financial compensation is preferred.
Well, you know, Greg, that was a fascinating story, and I'm sure the listening audience loved hearing it.
I think so. I have another story about my old grandfather, Jed, and he had this old tool shed. And if you like, I can go into all of the implements that he had inside his shed and where they came from.
Were you one of the boys who'd been whacking off in his tool shed?
We never, ever phrase a sentence that way. It's, am I one of the boys off in whose shed was whacking?
You were whacking, yeah. That's good.
So anyway, Green Lantern and Green Arrow. Let's give a little background on this. First of all, we read, for our first part here, we read issues number 76 through issue number 81.
Oh, I thought you were going to say 82.
No, not yet. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 chapters of this book, and those are what we're going to address here today, or tonight, rather. And as a little background on Green Lantern and Green Arrow, Nick, we're going to take people into Green Arrow in a minute, but I want to let you talk about Green Lantern at this point, because you've kind of read all of Green Lantern's Silver Age appearances. So what was the state of Green Lantern in 1970 when this run began?
Oh, man, that's a tough question. Kind of put me on the spot there. You know, 1970 wasn't that far removed from the character's resurgence into, or the redefinition of the character, so to speak, from the Golden Age Green Lantern into the more modern Hal Jordan interpretation that we all know and love, and the mythos of the core and whatnot. But I would argue that coming into this, the character kind of hit its first real lull in that time period, kind of treading water, so to speak. After a while, you know, as was the case with a lot of Silver Age comics, you kind of just started repeating some of the same stories over and over again, and after a few years, it felt like they had kind of run through a lot of the stories, and so I think a creative shakeup, which is what this was intended to be, was something of a breath of fresh air for the book.
Yeah, and Hal had already gone through a part of what would become kind of a trend for him, a very odd job changes. Yeah. They mentioned in this story that he was once an insurance salesman of some kind.
Yeah, a traveling insurance salesman at one point when he left Coast City. At one point he was a toy sales representative. I think that was after this, though. And there were a couple of others, at least that I know of.
A truck driver at one point too.
Truck driver, yeah, that's a good one. Truck driver, that was a good one.
The shark ate him.
But it is. I think people often remember him as the test pilot persona because that's the persona that Geoff Johns kind of brought back to the forefront and repopularized. And while that was his classic incarnation, there was a long stretch of time where that wasn't really part of the Green Lantern comics. So. Interesting to be reminded of that when we read this one.
Yeah, probably a good move to give him a job more exciting than insurance salesman. No knock to any insurance salesman out there that may be listening to the podcast.
Quite frankly, Greg, I think it brings a unique edge to the superhero. Like when you're in the middle of a fight and you have to consider the amount of damage you're doing and how much money that's going to cost your company and hurt the bottom line, it just adds a whole nother layer.
Are you suggesting that perhaps Hal Jordan would have been a natural foe for Lex Luthor? Or perhaps even an ally.
I think so. I think Hal Jordan's true arch enemy would be like Damage Control from Marvel or whatever the corporation is in Powerless that's cleaning up after all the battles. He's not a fan. Not a fan of these people who come in and make money off of the superhero fights.
That's right. They don't consider the potential damage here. But in any event, let's talk about the other side of the coin, Green Arrow. Now, Green Arrow, who had been around since 1940 or 41, around that time, the early 40s, and he was initially created, although there's some dispute about that. His creator has kind of disputed this idea, but most perceive Green Arrow to have been a Batman pastiche, a rich playboy who goes around fighting crime with the gig of being an archer. Mm-hmm. And he had an arrow cave and an arrow mobile and just a variety of things that had arrow in
them. A young sidekick named Speedy.
Named Speedy, who was not unlike Robin. It was pretty much a carbon copy of Batman. For the first, almost 30 years of the character, he was like that. He had a very different costume than the one that we're all used to today that looked very much like Robin Hood. He would go around and he would shoot arrows at criminals, never killing them. And he would solve mysteries and have adventures with his sidekick. And this was fine and well, but he was never popular enough to get his own ongoing series. He was in More Fun Comics back in the Golden Age. Mm-hmm. And when that ran its course, eventually, he migrated over and was brought into Justice League of America.
That's correct. And, you know, Greg right now is experiencing intermittent technical difficulties.
Congruence of events at about the same time. Say what?
No, nothing.
A congruence of events happened at about the same time and in the late 60s. This was around 1968, 69, around that time, that two issues in particular came out that were of grave importance. Around 1968 or 69, Denny O'Neil started writing Justice League of America with penciler Dick Dillon. And as Denny O'Neil was writing Justice League of America, he thought that some of these characters needed some shakeups because one of the things that you'll notice if you go back and read the early Justice League of America, and I know you've mentioned this to me, Nick, is those early Silver Age JLAs, all of the characters basically have the same voice, correct?
Yeah, except for Wonder Woman, because she has to clean the Hall of Justice periodically.
Right. So other than Wonder Woman, all of the male characters in Justice League of America in those days had essentially the same voice. It was alternating dialogue that could have been uttered by anyone. In other words, Batman would say the same things that the Flash or Superman would say. They were just generic adventure hero lines. So Denny O'Neil thought that wasn't interesting enough. He thought these characters needed more defined personalities within the group. Well, along the at the same time, there's a series called The Brave and the Bold, which featured team-ups every month. And in this one, Brave and the Bold number 85, penciler Neil Adams did the story. Denny O'Neill didn't write it, but Neil Adams was the artist on this issue. And for whatever reason, he was given the freedom to redesign Green Arrow. And for the very first time, with very little to no explanation, Green Arrow appears in this issue with his iconic, what I would consider to be his iconic look, with the hat and the multicolor green outfit with the sleeveless look and the goatee, the iconic Van Dyke beard that everybody knows from Green Arrow. Completely redesigned and drawn by Neil Adams. And this was a huge deal, and it was separate from what was going on in JLA. So you get this redesign in Brave and the Bold number 85. Meanwhile, over in Justice League of America, a couple of things happen that set the stage for the book that we're talking about tonight. Black Canary is brought over from Earth 2. And her husband is killed.
Yes.
And her husband, Larry Lance, is killed, and she is brought over.
During one of the numerous crossovers between the Justice Society and the Justice League.
Right. And the decision is made by Black Canary to stay on Earth 1
right.
and join the Justice League instead of being on the Justice Society so she wouldn't be reminded of her husband all the time. Along those lines, we start to see a blossoming attraction from Green Arrow to Black Canary. He starts putting the moves on her, and she resists him at first because she's still mourning for her husband. Then, in issue number 75, the real turning point happens. JLA 75, 1970, sets the stage for what will come in this series of stories that we're discussing today, because in JLA 75, Oliver Queen loses his fortune. Denny O'Neill decided that he wanted to take the character in a drastically different direction. So he had this character who at the time had been defined by being wealthy, took all of his money away, and losing his fortune gave a new perspective to Oliver Queen. And now Oliver Queen suddenly became the champion of the little guy. He became essentially an angry progressive who wanted to see left-wing policies implemented, wanted to go and fight for the disenfranchised, essentially. A social justice warrior, if you will. And that was a big departure from what we had seen before, but it gave Green Arrow, finally, that edge that would define him from that point forward. So we start this series off. Green Lantern, as you've mentioned, Nick, was struggling, fledgling around. And Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams were brought together with the hopes of saving this title. And one of the first things that they decided to do was bring Green Arrow in and make a co-headliner on the book. This is titled Green Lantern featuring co-starring Green Arrow. And so you have literal co-stars in your book, two characters that have struggled to make their way. And O'Neill's approach to these characters and Adams' approach to these characters was such that he thought that what was interesting was the contrast. So if you have Oliver Queen being a rebellious, left-wing, anti-authority guy, naturally you needed Green Lantern to be a conservative, play-by-the-rules, straight arrow type. And that creates the kind of dichotomy that defines this run, which defines these characters for the decade of the 70s, but really ended up defining these characters for many, many decades to come after this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really an interesting characterization of Green Lantern, especially because it hadn't really been established that he was a by-the-books kind of guy. He had already clashed with the Guardians many times.
Yep.
In his first few years of existence. So an interesting take, I think, was largely done to establish the difference between the two characters, but it winds up working, and it winds up working very well, and like you said, kind of setting a standard for the way the two characters would be portrayed for years to come.
And most likely, if this sort of thing was done today, it would get huge blowback.
Yes.
Because of the changes in characterization. It was just a different era. It was a time when you could do things like that and get away with it without the internet blowback that would follow.
What's really new is, I mean, for a character like Hal Jordan at the time to change his characterization, you know, he'd only been around seven, eight years at that point, so mm-hmm. not that big of a deal, whereas Green Arrow was one of the few characters to carry over from the Golden Age into the mainstream DC continuity, and so he had been established for quite some time at this point, so to make such a drastic shift in the way he was portrayed, had the internet been around back then, the internet would have hated it.
Yep. So let's get cracking on this, Nick. We're going to get started in April 1970 with Green Lantern number 76. This is the first story that is in the reprinted collected edition Green Lantern Green Arrow. You can find this on Amazon, at most local comic shops. Pretty popular collection. And the title of this story is No Evil Shall Escape My Sight, appropriately enough. And this is done to set the table for what was to come. And, Nick, this was about as bold a first issue as any creative run I can remember. What about you?
Yeah, it certainly pulls no punches when it comes to establishing the take on these characters that it wants to establish and telling the story that it wants to establish. It wears its politics very much on its sleeve, which in today's day and age wouldn't be that big of a deal, but in 1970, at a time when comics were supposed to be pure escapism and have no political content, this was insanely groundbreaking, and it's bewildering to me that it was able to exist in the form that it did.
Yeah, you have to remember, in 1970, the audience for comic books was still predominantly children.
Right.
That was still the primary target audience and the primary reading audience. It had started to age up because of the age of Marvel. You had seen college students starting to get into comics more and high schoolers starting to get into comics more, but still a very, very young audience. So it's even more bold when you think about that. And here on the very first page, you get the almost ominous start to this story as you see this classic Gil Kane pose of Hal Jordan flying through the city, and Denny O'Neill's narration establishes that this will not be a happy tale. This will not have a happy ending. It's basically going to be about how everything Green Lantern has believed in has been wrong, essentially. And that's a pretty bold opening statement. I also want to draw attention to something I just now noticed, actually. The really, really cool art where there's this truck driving in the bottom of the page, and Adams has drawn in really cool font Julie Schwartz, the editor's name, his name, and Denny O'Neill's name. Of course, Adams puts his name above O'Neill's on the truck, but it's really...
Once again, Greg's microphone has gone out. We're going to make fun of him every time it happens, folks. You and I are in on the joke together.
Is that Neil Adams lays out a page and puts in messages.
Absolutely. I think it's a wonderful...
So,
It's a really cool little technique. Adams was just very innovative like that. And like you said, putting his name above Denny O'Neill, reinforcing that Neil Adams, in his own mind, is the greatest thing that ever lived.
he might say he's the greatest man that ever lived.
He's got some A-double qualities about him, I suppose.
That's right. That's right.
After all, remember, it's not the DC on CW Universe. It's the Neil Adams on CW Universe. That's an actual quote from Neil Adams' interview, by the way.
Very true. So we get this opening scene of Hal Jordan comes across what he thinks are some thugs beating up an old fat guy, and he saves the old fat guy. Well, it turns out
endearing him to Greg and I instantly. Like,
yeah,
already we are like, wait a minute, Green Lantern is a man of our people. Who cares
about
who cares about what Green Arrow has to say?
That's right. Listen, Green Arrow doesn't appreciate the plight of the fat man in America.
Nope.
And so the fat man gets saved and thanks Lantern. Well, it turns out the fat guy is kind of a slumlord, and he's threatening to evict these poor people from this establishment. So Green Arrow and Green Lantern have this confrontation, and it leads to one of the most immortal scenes of the era.
Well, and it also leads to what will be the first of approximately I don't know, about 82,000 scenes of Green Arrow being a sanctimonious douche and chastising Green Lantern over the course of the next, you know, 15 to 20 issues.
Yes. So Hal is being read the Riot Act by Green Arrow about how he's interfering where he didn't belong, and he's helping a fat cat to evict all these poor people, and he's just blindly serving authority. And Hal says, "Heezy, you've got no cause to yell at me. I have a job. I do it." And of course, Green Arrow jumps right to Nazis.
Yep.
I've heard that line before at the Nazi war trials. So you definitely get an establishment of the kind of relationship they're going to have here. And Green Arrow's got a lot of great points, but he is extremely aggressive about making them. And to Denny O'Neill's point, he does have Green Arrow's mouth get him in trouble a few times during the course of this book. So this leads to the Immortal Exchange, where a gentleman, an African-American gentleman, asks, says he wants to ask the Ringslinger a question. And he says, "Now, you work for the Blueskins, and how on a planet someplace you helped out the Orangeskins, and you done considerable for the Purpleskins, only their skins you never bothered with, the Blackskins. I want to know, how come? Answer me that, Mr. Green Lantern." And this is what sets the stage for the entire book, as Hal says, "I can't." And because, come on, if they had done a Green Lantern movie in 1970, William Shatner would have played him. Come on,
I
you
don't,
know that.
I don't disagree with that. And maybe a young Robert Redford as Green Arrow, by the way.
Yeah. See, now you're talking.
By the way, I want to call attention to something, Greg, that is in this trade. If you'll notice on this page you just read, the bottom part of the page is occupied by a large logo. Would you like to know the reasoning for that?
Advertisements, I'm assuming?
Yes. Would you like to know the specific advertising?
Mm-hmm.
Hostess Fruit Pies, my friend. This was one of numerous instances back in the day where the single issues would have actual sequential art from the story stacked on top of Hostess fruit pie ads, and this happened all the time back then. And yet, I would remind you that a couple of years ago when DC tested it out with those Snickers ads, people lost their ever-loving minds as if it was the worst thing that anybody could ever do.
Yep, absolutely. Ironically, the same people who often opine about how only old comics are good.
Indeed. Just wanted to point that out and bring up Hostess fruit pies.
So, this issue, in the end, we find that, of course, they beat up the slumlord or his thugs, rather, they end up overthrowing him with a district attorney's help. But what it does is it makes Hal realize that maybe he's had some of this wrong. And the Guardians step in, and they chastise Green Lantern, but Green Arrow sticks up for him and says, "Listen, you idiots are up there and you judge us humans, but you don't know what it's like to feel. You don't know what emotions are. You don't know how things are like for actual living beings, because you sit up there on high and you look at everything with pure logic and no heart."
And it also includes a very forced reference to the recent assassinations of both Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King.
With a really nice piece of artwork, by the way.
Great piece of artwork, but what it, like, read the scene again. What sense does it make for Green Arrow to be talking about those two men in this rant about the Guardians? Like, it comes very much from out of left field.
He's talking about a moral cancer that is rotting the very soul of the country.
Out of left field. Get it, Greg?
He's talking about a moral cancer that's rotting the very soul of the country. And it was a very tumultuous time in our country. 1970 was, you know, as tumultuous as it gets. And so Arrow and Lantern are trying to convince the Guardians to come off their perch and come down and learn what it's like to be human, essentially. Or be human, if you will. And I want to ask you, Nick, to this point, had they established the Guardians as these kind of cold, unfeeling characters that they would come to be in this story and later stories?
Yes, very much so. Almost from, I don't know about from the first appearance, from the first issue, but very early on, the conflict between Hal and the Guardians was a major plot point. In fact, over the first couple of years of the series, Hal reiterating how there was something about the Guardians he just didn't trust. It wasn't until years after this, kind of in the in-between of this and the Jeff Johns run, that they kind of became, you know, kindly old aliens, for lack of a better term, that had no real sinister edge about them. So much so that when one of them actually did something nefarious, with the old-timer losing his mind on the Mosaic planet in the early 90s, it was genuinely shocking. For some reason, they dropped the Guardian tension subplot. They also did bizarre subplots along the way that involved the Guardians leaving their post as Guardians to go have sex. Literally,
with
to go have Zamorons. Sex. To go have sex with the Zamorons for multiple years in, like, some sort of alternate dimension. So, you know, the Guardian characterization...
They wanted
over
to
the decades,
sow been, their royal oats.
Sow their royal oats, yeah. So the Guardian characterization over the years has been something of a unique situation.
So the end result of all of this, and the ultimate setup for what's to come, is that the Guardians decide, the human makes a point. And so they send one of their representatives to Earth, and he takes the form of a human with the idea that he is going to travel across the country with Green Lantern and Green Arrow to learn what it means to be human, as they are trying to figure out who they are and who the country is at this time as well.
Now let me ask you this, Greg. Yeah. What happens to Star City and Coast City in the interim? Like, they've abandoned their posts, essentially.
Well, it's a good point. I guess the crime rates were low in Coast City and Star City. I don't know. I mean, it's really a good question. Actually, we'll talk about in the next Long Book Hunters what Carol Ferris was up to. I was going to say maybe Carol Ferris was patrolling, but no, she's had an interesting time of it as well. So we'll talk about her in the next edition. But yeah, so basically they set up this cross-country road trip that forms the narrative framework of Green Lantern, Green Arrow. And it's going to be Hal, Ollie, and this Guardian who they take to calling the Old Timer because he looks like an old guy, as you would expect. He's basically just a Guardian with white skin and a suit. And, so they go on a road trip. And, Nick, tell me about this first issue. What did you think about this as far? Obviously, some aspects of this issue do not age well. Heavy-handed, the line about the blue skins and the purple skins, there are aspects that obviously don't hold up well. But what did you think about this as far as setting the stage for what was to come?
Oh, it absolutely does an excellent job of establishing what the take on the characters are and kind of what their status quo is going to be and what kind of dynamic they're going to be exploring going forward. But to bring up your point about it being heavy-handed, one thing we should point out is this was just a different era of comic storytelling. Yeah. In the modern era, this one issue that we just saw, the events of this one issue, probably have been stretched out over at least three or four issues, and thus, a lot of the dialogue and heavy-handedness would have been much more subtle, and they would have been able to be a little bit more vague in their dialogue. With the way comic stories were paced back then, you really had to cut a pace. You had to have characters come out and state what they were thinking outright,
so
rather than hinting.
Normally, our situation...
Rather than hinting around about
you
it.
Cut on me.
Yeah, right. Rather than hinting around about it because you just don't have, you know, the space to be vague. You got to come right out and say what you mean and mean what you say. It's a very straightforward approach to storytelling that doesn't really exist anymore.
Right, and that's a great discussion point we teased during the show, is that normally our situation with Long Book Hunter episodes is, you know, Nick reads them pretty quickly, and I read them much less quickly, but we get the whole thing read. One of the things that we ran into with this is these stories are just so dense. Not in a bad way. It's just comics from this era just take longer to read. There's more going on. There's more to follow.
The idea of the image-only panel, where it's a panel or a splash page with nothing but image, no words, does not really exist in this era. You having to be so economical with your storytelling, every panel needs words and every panel needs dialogue or interior monologue or something to keep the plot along because they're pretty much all, if they're not one and dones, they're two and dones. Like, and two parters in this era were exceedingly rare. So you got to tell your story and wrap it up in about 22 pages, which is something of a tough ask for a lot of writers, in my opinion.
Exactly, and I'll be honest, I don't know if modern writers could do this style of comic. We've seen that Denny O'Neil could do more decompressed storytelling later on. And that's what we grew up with. We're used to decompressed storytelling. So when we see compressed storytelling, it almost throws us off our game, because I don't know that a modern writer could write this way. And I got to be honest with you, Nick. I know that it's different. I was really impressed as this book went along, as the ensuing chapters came along, with A, Denny O'Neill's ability to narrate, to write narrative dialogue, and B, with the ability of O'Neill to, and Adams both, actually, to progress the story in such a manner that, yes, it's dense and it takes a long time to read, but it flows in a logical way.
Right,
that,
it doesn't feel overly rushed. It doesn't feel like they're just burning through things, you know?
No, absolutely not. It's really... You compare it to something. I recently read one of the top Green Arrow stories of the 1950s, which is a story that things just – I mean, you want to talk about things just happening.
Yep.
In that era. It's just like one panel, he's Oliver Queen. The next panel, he's in a dueling archery contest with his villain. It's very strange. This the flow is very natural.
Are you suggesting that it flows like a Silver Age comic is supposed to flow?
Exactly, or the beginning of the Bronze Age at this point.
We're kind of in that fuzzy area, I suppose. Silver to bronze.
Yeah, this is kind of, a lot of people think of this as kind of the start of the Bronze
Age. Which is one thing that's always confused me. All right, so you have the Silver Age and you have the Bronze Age. What's the age after bronze?
Everybody just called it the Modern Age.
Okay, and so the Modern Age is like 30 years long, while all the other ages are like 10 to 15 years max.
Right. It's very strange. I think some have taken to calling it the Copper Age, which I really don't like. You're eventually going to run out of metals.
I think we're in a reality age, personally. Or what about
the Ruthless Aggression Age?
Or what about the Age of Honor? Let's not discount that as a potential name.
Ooh,
for this age.
The Age of Honor. See, I think the 90s was the Ruthless Aggression Age, perhaps, or the Attitude Age.
The Attitude Age, yeah.
The 2000s were the Ruthless Aggression Age.
Ruthless Aggression Age.
Then we went through the PG Age, and the Reality Age.
The Reality Age, yep.
And now, you know, I guess we're in the New Age.
Or the Age of Honor. I still say it's the Age of Honor, personally.
The Age of Honor.
And I won't accept any other answer than Age of Honor. And I'm pretty sure no one knows what I'm talking about at this point. So we're just going to move on.
Any event... So they set up this cross-country road trip. But these dense issues we talk about, there's standalone stories, but it's all part of this overarching narrative of Hal and Ollie and the old-timer trying to learn about America. And
about each other.
And
like, really, about really, each other. Yeah, the overarching story is about these three characters going on a journey of both discovery and self-discovery. So while the actual, like, in terms of villains and plots and that kind of thing, though none of those arc over, the characterizations and the character development very much do carry throughout each issue. To the point where when the run ends, Green Lantern is, I mean, definitely a different character than he was coming in.
Absolutely. And in our next issue that we encounter, this one is called Journey to Desolation. They're traveling through a mountainous era. Mountainous area. It's never quite made clear where they're at in the country. But they get attacked by these coal miners, and
hillbilly mountain folk.
And so they we can only assume they're in Tennessee then. And they then
that's a long way from Star City, which I've always believed to be on the West Coast, to Tennessee. Off page. They've made it quite some time. Quite a
while. Well,
they
may not be in Tennessee. It's just when you say hillbilly, that's what I think of.
Greg casting aspersions on the fine people of the state of Tennessee.
Hey, I'm just saying, the lyrics of Rocky Top are a unique situation.
Oh, a unique situation. But yeah,
you should know more than anyone, Nick. You've had harsher things to say about the folks in Tennessee than I have.
I've never said such things in my life. This is yet another instance of you having baseless accusations about me being anti various groups of people that I'm not. I have no real qualms with.
Nick, I've heard it in college. I heard it in college.
You heard it in college. I got news for you. I was drunk most of the time in college. So none of that
That's true. That's correct.
None of that counts for the record.
So anyway, they meet this group of miners, and after a little miscommunication at first, they learn that the miners are trying to essentially rebel against their evil coal mine owner, Mr. Soames. And along the way, we meet a folk singer who was named Johnny Walden, old Johnny Walden, who's in the vein of Bob Dylan, who actually gets name dropped in this story, by the way. And so Hal and Ollie decide to help the coal miners against this this Soames guy. And what's this guy's name? What's the Soames guy's first name, Nick? I can't remember.
I don't even know. And this one was one. What exactly were they saying he was doing wrong? Like, not paying them enough? I didn't.
Slapper. His name is Slapper. That's right.
Slapper Soames.
Slapper Soames.
That's a pretty awesome name. But I forget what their actual beef was with him.
He's essentially, they say that he's a mean man, and he sends in these guys from outside, these bullies, to come in up the workers.
Are they suggesting that he a bad man?
He a bad man. He like the Gov Bob Riley.
Gov Bob Riley. What about Gov Bob Bentley?
He likes to fondle breasts.
He also likes to watch Greg and I while we do podcasts for some reason.
Yeah, it's very unsettling. Speaking of unsettling, the workers are unsettled by these bullies that come in and rough them up.
Good
as they
Lord.
Work in the
We are forcing them through tonight.
And so basically the miners are being abused by this Soames guy. And the Soames guy has taken this folk singer. That's the other thing you forgot about, Nick. Johnny Walden.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He's going to execute Johnny Walden. He's going to hang him, which is pretty harsh.
Seems a bit excessive.
He's going to hang
when
the
all
guy.
He did was sing, when all he did was sing songs. And
all he did
up.
Was sing shitty songs.
Yeah.
His music was terrible, but you shouldn't hang the guy for it.
And Soames' real complaint is that he's getting everybody stirred up, which means he would have hated the possum-eating redneck.
That's right. Of course, there's a nice twist here at the end as we learn that Soames actually wanted them to get stirred up because he wanted to make an example out of Walden.
That's right.
To show them all, you know, what happened, step out of line.
Mm-hmm.
So Hal and Ollie help these
guys
out.
You know what happens, miners? You know what happens when you cross Slapper Soames? Huh? You know what happens?
You know what happens?
You just made the noose.
What did you think of this issue, Nick?
It was good. It had some great comedy elements. I think the first one, the first issue was a little bit more unintentionally funny, whereas this one seemed to be going for comedy. Like, there's no way not to laugh at the character of Slapper Soames. He is just absolutely hilarious, especially when he's saying things like "shucks" and stuff like that. It's just it's a little comedic villain there.
Yeah, there was a lot of good stuff in here. There's also an interesting little subplot with the old timer where he finds a child who is lost and can't find her daddy, and so he kind of consoles the child, and he has this awesome like William Shatner esque inner thoughts of a strange feeling, an emotion, as this tiny earthling embraces me. Is this what it is to be human? So we're starting to see even the old-timer already is starting to kind of feel these foreign things called emotions that the Guardians don't know a whole hell of a lot about. So anyway, this story wraps up, and I thought it was okay. You know, this wasn't my favorite one in the collection, but it was solid.
Yeah, solid.
And got the job done. You know, it showed that they're going to help the little guys out. And
showed you what the format of the book was going to be going forward, them kind of going across America and, you know, intervening themselves in various nefarious situations.
Exactly. And we see, you know, they help out the little guy. They have a little bit of a disagreement with Hal and Ollie at a point in it. And then we're going to get into the first introduction, as opposed to the second introduction. I don't know why I said first introduction. We're going to get into the introduction of Black Canary into this story. We mentioned earlier that in JLA there was a sort of burgeoning attraction between Green Arrow and Black Canary, largely one-sided to that point, but not entirely. She was starting to get stirred a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently, it's told to us by an editor's note from Julius Schwartz that in a previous issue of JLA, Superman had made a motorcycle for Black Canary for some reason that I can't even begin to fathom. And so she's riding this motorcycle, and she comes across, in this story, a kind of loving, a way of death. She comes across a biker gang that leads to one of the best pages in the entire collection, which is I don't know how to describe it, Nick. It's like an entire page splash, but with text on it, of Dinah basically whooping the ass of this entire biker gang.
Whooping that ass like the female Danny Hodge of this biker gang.
She's like the combination of Danny Hodge and Dr. Death and Stone Cold into one blonde figure. And this is I don't know about you, Nick. I thought this was a standout. It's not just the artwork, the actual pencils. It's the colors. It's everything about this. Just a really standout page, and how the letters are weaved throughout the fight scene. Brilliant stuff.
Yeah, really good. Almost evocative of a modern-day comic.
Yep.
So you still see these kind of techniques used today, so I can't imagine how groundbreaking it was back then.
Yeah. It's almost almost is reminiscent of some of the techniques of Andrea Sorrentino and David Aja that they have used in their respective Archer books in recent years. So the premise of this one is another rather interesting sign of the times, in that it's the first of a couple of stories that center around Native Americans. Except the Native Americans are referred to derogatorily by the villains throughout as Redskins.
Mm-hmm.
And the Native Americans refer to our heroes as Pale Faces.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, what do you say, Pale Faces? And to which
we say food.
Responds,
pronto.
Food, pronto. Why don't we ever say that when we go into a restaurant, Nick? Why don't we sit down and tell the waitress, food, pronto?
Speaking of things that are said by various incarnations of the Green Arrow, this is unrelated, Greg, but I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do every time I walk into a room where you are now on. I'm going to look around at everybody in the room solemnly and just nod my head and say, can you guys give us the room for a minute? Because that's what John Diggle does on seemingly every episode of Arrow for like the last 3 months. And it works for him every time, so I'm just going to start doing it and see if it works.
Are you watching Arrow right now?
No, I just thought of it.
Just give us the room. What if nobody left when he said that?
Why are we giving you the room?
No, this is my room. I pay for this room.
You do this every day, John. For God's sake, we'd like to be on some of these discussions as well. Can you just give us the room?
Quite frankly, none of you except Oliver are important.
Oh.
All right.
Well, we'll just go kill ourselves then.
Anyway, so this story revolves around a conflict between this biker gang, and seemingly, actually, between the biker gang and the, quote, Redskins. But what it actually results in is Black Canary being knocked out and left an amnesiac of sorts. And Green Arrow and Green Lantern are, of course, infuriated by this, particularly Green Arrow, as they try to find out what happened to their friend and Green Arrow's burgeoning love interest. Well, that is when we get introduced to who I thought – I had never heard of this character before, but I thought this was a really interesting character. This villain called Joshua, who's almost a Charles Manson-like figure. But instead,
it seems to have some sort of actual mind control capabilities of some sort.
Yes. We find out that this this individual called Joshua, who seems to be leading this cult, has somehow brainwashed the Black Canary with this power that he has. And he is a very much like Charles Manson in terms of his belief in a race war. And he wants them to eliminate all the non-white races out there, which is, if you've ever followed the Charles Manson story, has a lot of parallels to that. So, as you well know, Nick. And
no.
I'm not implying. No.
Good
no.
Lord. For people who don't have the context, Greg, come on.
Oh,
now.
I'm sorry. No, my context is not that Nick Duke is part of the Charles Manson cult. My context for this, for those that don't know, is Mr. Duke enjoys reading about some of the more odd killings in U.S. history. So
we're just going to move on at this point. There's no good way to describe this in brief.
Yes. So anyway, but you would agree with me, right, that this is parallel?
Yeah, I mean, and I think the time frame of it, you know, 1970 compared to, you know, August of 69 when all that stuff went down, and the trial, I would imagine, was probably just getting ready to heat up about this time. So probably very fresh in the headlines in terms of the true motivations of the Manson family when it came to carrying out these murders.
Yes, and so he has brainwashed Black Canary and a bunch of other people that are following him and made her think that she believes in him wholeheartedly, and she's forgotten all – he's made her forget all about Green Arrow, Green Lantern, who she was before, her dead husband, all of that. And the deciding point in the book comes when he orders her to kill Green Arrow with a gun, and as she's staring at him, she can't do it. Even though he's ordering her to do it, she cannot, even with the brain control, bring herself to kill Ollie.
Even before that, Greg, I think I want to call out this. We get another outstanding splash page of, for people who aren't aware of the history of the Black Canary to this point, they kind of recap her entire Silver Age existence in one page.
Yep.
In a series of images that is set against the backdrop of a larger image of her face. She sheds tears. And it's very difficult to describe in audio alone, but if you see it, I think you'll look at it and go, man, that came out in 1970, and kind of have your mind blown by it a little bit.
Yeah, if you have the trade collection that we're looking at, this is on page 70 of the trade collection. And if you have the original comic, it's on page 14, which if you have the original comic, congratulations. But it's on page 14 of that. It's on page 70 of the collection. And this, like Nick said, this is just an incredible page. It's a silhouette almost of her face. The way that they show her Silver Age origin, as he mentioned, the death of her husband, the romance with Green Arrow, the weird Superman motorcycle, just outstanding stuff. And I got to be honest with you, Nick, I think my main exposure to Green Arrow and Green Lantern, Green Arrow going into this was I had the second volume of the trade collection, and so I had read the first issue and I had read all stuff in the second half. I had never read these issues before. This one in particular, blown away by Neil Adams.
Yep.
Absolutely blown away.
Well, also by Denny O'Neil being able fit the entire history of a character into such a small amount of space, and it doesn't feel overly rushed. You kind of feel like you get a little bit of the emotional plight of this character. It's a great job by pretty much everybody involved of, in the course of, what, like 14 pages here, you've gotten pretty much everything you need to know about the Black. And once again, Greg's mic has gone out, so we're going to make fun of him, folks.
Yeah, it's very, very, very impressive. And so in the end, of course, she can't bring herself to kill Oliver Queen and overcomes the brainwashing. Joshua, through, in a way, I'm not entirely sure how this is possible, but Joshua ends up accidentally shooting himself in the chest and killing himself. And then of course Ollie and Dinah have a great moment here at the end, and Lantern is left with the harsh reality that Joshua was just one of what are going to be countless people with evil in their hearts, that there's just no reason for them to feel the way that they do, and he was going to wipe out the Native American village that they had temporarily stopped at earlier in the issue. So I thought Joshua was a great character. I actually wish they hadn't killed him off, because I think there was a lot of potential with this villain, and potentially could be again if they were to resurrect a character or modernize him for the modern era, similar to Joshua.
Yeah, I agree. It was a great issue. Like I said, I mean, just another example of how, even though it's not decompressed, these stories can still absolutely work in the modern context.
Next up, we had a story titled Ulysses Starr is Still Alive. And right from the cover, you can tell this is going to be something, because the cover has Green Lantern tied in a crucifix position to a totem pole, as Green Arrow, wearing an Indian headdress, has his arrow pulled back and says, "My redskin brothers find you guilty, and I am your executioner." So we know that some kind of shenanigans are going to be up in this one. And indeed, we find out that there's this incredibly racist lawyer guy who is trying to help these lumberjacks chop down trees and take over this land that belongs to, or that where the Native Americans live. And we get an expression such as in a pig's ear, which is unique. So Lantern finds out what's going on. He says, well, legally, they're right about it. And, of course, this pisses off Green Arrow. And he says, we got to fight. We got to help the Native Americans and fight. And this leads to the first of the real blows between Hal and Ollie, where Hal says, well, if you're going to break the law, you can count me out. And Ollie says, I'll do that gladly. And they storm off. And Hal kind of second-guesses himself, and he goes. And it leads to one of my favorite pages in the book, which Hal goes to visit the old-timer. And we've all been here before. He goes there seeking advice from the old-timer. And the old-timer proceeds to tell a long, rambling story about how he's trying to wrap his head around human existence. I see certain phenomena. I observe that upheaval your nation is experiencing is logical. Your heroes are warriors. Your myths and legends tell of battles won. It is natural you turn to violence. Yet I cannot condemn this, for it shows a great... Oh, my God, it's a Jim Ross statement. Yet I cannot condemn this, for it shows a great spirit, a spirit which properly channeled can take you beyond the stars, at which point it becomes bored and leaves. Oh, God, I love it. But, yeah, so this is after the old-timer arguing with himself, and... you know, so Hal flies off and decides that he's going to try to solve it a different way. He's going to try to figure out a legal way to help these Native Americans win their situation. Now, that's the good part of the story. The part of the story that didn't really work for me was Oliver disguising himself as a yellow Native American spirit man.
Yeah, this was an exceptionally weird... probably the most odd of the stories that we read for this Long Book Hunters. It was interesting for sure.
Yeah, so it ends up leading to this, you know, Ollie in this guise as the Native American spirit man. He's yellow, so Green Lantern's ring won't work against him. Well, Green Lantern shows up with this U.S. representative to help the Indians with their plight. It leads to a fight between Oliver and Green Arrow where they beat the crap out of each other and end up knocked out and concussed, presumably, by logs. And in the end, of course, the evil lawyer guy gets exposed for his corruption and they get arrested at the end of the issue. And it leads to a campfire scene as the old-timer sits around... you know, kind of giving some sage advice to Ollie and Hal about how humanity has to stop hitting, killing each other. And actually, this is a really great line that probably applies today as well, where, you know, sooner or later, humanity must stop hitting, killing, which lead to hatred and bloodshed. I pray you find the splendor in yourselves before it is too late. So, you know, it ends in a pretty cool way, I thought, but overall... probably my least favorite issue of the ones that we read.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. You know, bizarre, kind of boring congressman character being worked in here. Yeah, aforementioned Oliver dressing up as an Indian spirit for some reason. Just a weird series of subplots, although you do get some pretty good old-timer stuff, and it does flesh out kind of the role that the old-timer is really going to play of sage advice giver over the course of this issue.
Yes, indeed. That leads to one of the strong issues, I thought, of the run. This is a tale called "Even an Immortal Can Die,"
and one of the coolest covers of the entire run.
Yes, great cover that's set up like a newspaper cover, mm-hmm. which of course appeals to Nick's and my background as newspapermen,
journos, if you will.
Journos, that's right. That's what Snapper Carr would call us.
That's right.
So one of the things I want to point out, we delve into the actual story, is the inker actually changes on this. All the stories to this point had been inked by Frank Giacoya. I'm assuming I'm saying that right, maybe not. This one, Adam's anchor switches to the legendary Dick Giordano, and you can actually tell a difference in the way that the art turns out, the finished art turns out. So not that any of the – all the art's been great to this point, and this art's great too, but it's just different. You know what I mean, Nick?
I think it's a little better, personally. I think the lines have a little bit more definition to them. I think the shadows kind of pop a little bit more. I like it a little bit better, even though I really enjoyed the first few issues' art as well.
I agree with that. And I think that in the first few issues, what stood out were those really experimental panels. And in this, it's a regular artwork that stands out. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. It pops a little bit more. So this is actually a really interesting story because we have our three guys. They get into it. They seem to be almost coming to an end of their journey. They're both talking. They're all three talking about time, that it's probably time for them to end their cross-country road trip and just kind of process what all they've seen and done. Well, around that time, they just have a random car accident. No villain behind it, no ill motives, just a bad driver swerves in front of them, and they drive off a bridge and nearly die. And I thought that was really different and really cool. And because Hal has promised to use his ring as little as possible on this road trip, they decide to hitch a ride with this nearby boat. That the boat rescues them, brings them on, and the boat is shipping toxic chemicals. This was a big deal at the time. We were just starting to get some of the EPA environmental regulations going across the country, and they are shipping toxic chemicals to be disposed of. Well, there's an overheated boiler incident. Hal goes down there. The boiler explodes. Hal is rendered unconscious and in grave danger. And so the Guardian, the old timer, is left with the choice. He can either transport Hal to the hospital, or he can stay and stop the chemicals from spilling into the river and poisoning the river. The logical thing, he says, the greatest good for the greatest number of people would be, of course, to stop the chemicals from going in and ruining the environment. But he's learned to become fond of Hal Jordan, become a friend. He knows what the word friend means now. And so his love for Hal Jordan leads him to take Hal to the hospital and leave Green Arrow behind to help with the boiler situation. Unfortunately, they end up having to throw the chemicals into the river in order to keep them from exploding and killing them all on the ship.
His voice has gone out again. Isn't he a jackass? Indeed.
Sorry, Nick, you cut out on there.
Yeah, you cut out on me as well. So why don't you just restate what you were saying there?
Oh, well, what was the last thing you heard me say?
I don't. Oh, you're talking about the choice that the old timer had to make.
Yes. Yeah, so even though he recognizes that he should make the choice to save the chemicals, he opts to save his friend instead, to save Hal. GA stays behind. Unfortunately, they end up having to dispose of the chemicals in the river. This does not sit well with the Guardians. They are not happy with their brethren. They can't believe he's made this decision. And he says, you know what? I'm guilty. And even though Ollie gets another great chance to call the Guardians out on their bullshit, and Hal as well, the Guardians, or the old-timer, admits that he's guilty. And so they sentence him to a trial, or they order him to go to a trial on this planet we've never heard of before that is in charge of intergalactic trials or something called the Tribune. And, Nick, Guardians overreact here, wouldn't you say?
That's kind of been their character, though, for a long time. They overreact here. They show no attempt to understanding whatsoever. And they just come off as sanctimonious douches. It's so interesting to me that judgmental, sanctimonious douche Green Arrow can't find any common ground with judgmental, sanctimonious douche Guardians. They really are two separate ends of the same spectrum. Yep.
Yes, two sides of a coin. You've got the extreme authoritarian, judgmental douches and the extreme anti-authoritarian, judgmental douche. So,
and yet both believe that they are the people who should be telling everybody else what's best for them.
Absolutely. Now, this, of course, this leads them into the Tribune planet, and they quickly find that things are not as they appear to be. They find out that this character named the Judge has overthrown the Tribune and used his robots that he's created to take over and essentially make a mockery of the trial system. There is no trial. Everybody's guilty, and the punishment for everything is death. Again, very harsh. So Hal and Ollie, what I really like about this issue, in addition to the moral ramifications, I really love how O'Neill and Adams force Oliver and Hal to use their ingenuity and their thinking and their brains instead of their brawn, instead of their arrows and their ring. You still get to see some trick arrows. You still get to see the ring get used in the end. But by and large, they have to think their way out of this situation, which I thought was a really cool change for Green Arrow and Green Lantern.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the storyline reason for that is because at this point in the series, they've been on Earth with people who, quite frankly, don't pose much threat to them. Whereas here, in the far reaches of space, especially Green Arrow finds himself at something of a disadvantage constantly. And so they're forced to use a little bit more of their ingenuity and intellect as opposed to their special abilities.
And there's a really cool thing that happens here. The old timer is sentenced to death, and he is going to die, and he's completely fine with it. He's completely reserved to the fact that he's going to die until it's actually happening. And even though he's still fine with it, he gets locked in this tube and essentially drowned. Like, he's filled with this weird pink material that's going to cover him up and encase him and smother him to death. And Lantern ends up breaking in at the last minute and saving him. And when asked how he survived, it's actually a pretty great little moment that actually made me chuckle to myself, where Hal says, "Old timer, how did you survive?" And he says, "Quite simply, I merely held my breath. On your Earth, I learned a valuable lesson. Where there is life, there is hope." And he has this kind of smirk on his face. And it's the first time we've seen the old timer actually use a little bit of humor there. That, you know, he just held his breath, basically, and that's how he survived, as obvious as that is. Thought that was a really cool, another really cool bit of character development, old-timer, and just a really good issue that sets up also the dichotomy of they overthrow the Judge, and the Tribune is just like, all right, well, we'll take our places back, and Ollie kind of makes them think about the fact, well, did you ever sit back and wonder, you know, what gives you the right to even do this, to, like, who appointed you the authorities to make all these decisions in the first place? And it actually causes them to reconsider what they're doing. And so they decide to start thinking about what the situation is. So what did you make of this issue, Nick?
I very much enjoyed it. As we discussed offline, I found these two, because we're about to discuss the other one here, I enjoyed these two off-world issues. I thought they were a welcome change of pace. Not that any of the other issues were bad per se, but it goes to show you that this run was really able to do a lot of different things, and they weren't pulling off a swashbuckling galactic adventure wasn't beyond their reach.
No, consider that we've gone from a story about a Native American reservation and a cult leader to an outer space adventure with aliens and robots, and it doesn't seem out of place.
Absolutely.
Now, this leads to an issue that, like the last issue, is excellent and actually may be my favorite one in this collection. This is the last one we'll be talking about tonight in the Long Book Hunters. This is the chapter entitled
Death Be My Destiny.
Yes, Death Be My Destiny. With a great cover. Black Canary guest starring Black Canary in the Population Explosion. Really awesome cover in an era where there were almost exclusively awesome covers in comics. This is one of the things that I was going to talk about at the end of the show, is just this cover gallery is reminiscent. I mean, they just don't make them like this anymore, nope. Man. The comics, as much as I love comics today, as much as I love some of the variant covers and stuff that we get today, on average, they just don't make them like this anymore.
No, it's hard to do a cover in this style anymore.
Yeah.
they were just they were up time, but they all work, man. They all are breathtaking to look at. So,
yep.
It's a different time and a different place, quite frankly.
This is our first real chance in person to see the Guardians since the beginning of the story, and this first page of Death Be My Destiny has almost a or not almost it's clearly a sorry. A satire of the classic Uncle Sam poster, mm-hmm. I Want You, but it's a Guardian saying that he wants you to answer to the charges brought against yourself, and he's talking to the old-timer. Hal and Ollie and Dinah appeal on behalf of their friend the old-timer to the Guardians, and of course, because it's the Guardians, their pleas fall on deaf ears, and their punishment for the old-timer is that they make him mortal. And they rule that he is to live his life on the planet from which the Owens came, Maltus, where he will go and he will live his life out as mortal and eventually die.
Mm-hmm.
And he's fine with this, oddly enough. Like, he actually accepts it and goes with it, even though his friends are very upset. And Hal has a great outburst at the Guardians and basically lets them know that... it is a little bit funny, though, because he's really, like, riding both sides of the fence here. Like, he could very easily turn in his ring, but he says, I suddenly find I've lost my respect for you. I'm not sure I want to keep this ring. I think maybe you should be high in my hell.
But then now, again,
I'm not resigning. Not yet. But I'm considering it. Believe that, Guardians.
But then they follow it with an amazing page.
Oh, God. Yeah. Talk about that page, Nick.
Yeah, the next page kind of has the Guardian sitting there in the upper left-hand corner talking about the potential of losing Hal Jordan. And the larger image on the page is Hal Jordan, but a large portion of his body is taken over by an outline of the galaxy. Like, there are stars and planets in the outline of his body. And inside the outline of his body, you see he and Green Arrow and the old-timer and Black Canary traveling to the cosmos. It's again, another panel that's exceedingly difficult to describe in audio, but if you see it, you'll know what I'm talking about. It really is a breathtaking panel.
And the narration, again, I know there's a lot of people out there that don't like narration in comics because of the era in which we've grown up, but when it's done like this, I don't mind it at all because Denny O'Neil just has a way with words, man. Like, some of these descriptions are like out of a novel or something. Like, it's really impressive.
Isn't Greg a douche?
Describing things. So they go to Maltus, and they encounter what I thought was a particularly striking issue in that it kind of applies to a state. We're not going to get political or anything on this, but they arrive on this planet, and they find, much to the surprise of the old-timer, that Maltus has exploded in population, as we mentioned from the cover, that the last time they checked the Maltus, which was, quote, a mere eon ago, there was no population, basically. Very few people on Maltus. Now, it's overcrowded with people. And when they get there, these people don't like, essentially, foreigners coming to their planet.
And especially Black Canary, including the line, a woman, destroy her.
Destroy her.
Something tells me Mr. Barnett would have enjoyed a trip to this planet.
So they say, go away, we don't want you here, get off our world. And, you know, that can pretty well apply, sadly, to current events as well at times. So,
if you don't think like I do, then get out.
Get out. Yeah, you're not from around here, boy. So it's just that for as much as we talk about the dated material, unfortunately, these issues are still prevalent today. So it does still have a modern context. So they find out that the planet has become overpopulated as a result of this convoluted thing where this meteor they passed through, or this comet that passed by, left gases on their planet that rendered everyone infertile, essentially. They couldn't have kids, and so everybody got old, and they were worried that their race would die out. So this woman decided to start growing test tube babies. Well, she got out of control with it, and then people started having their kids again, finally, And now the planet is overpopulated, and they're dealing with all of the problems that are associated with overpopulation. So this leads to a conflict where they overthrow this lady and deal with some of these social issues as well. There's some great lines, some great 70s lines in here from Green Arrow. You know, a pretty hilarious way that he decides to distract the rioters by putting on a magic show, or trick archery show, I should say. One of the other things we haven't talked about, we're used to Green Arrow calling Black Canary Pretty Bird. Mm-hmm. But here, in these comics, he calls her Bird Lady, mm-hmm. which is not quite as
romantic. Not quite as suave or debonair, but, you know.
Bird Lady.
Ollie was still working his way up to truly romancing Black Canary, so perhaps he was saving his best material for later.
That's true. And did you or did you not read this character of, what's her name?
In the voice of Ed Asner as Granny Goodness?
As Granny Goodness, yep.
Yes, absolutely. There's no other. Or Katharine Hepburn.
Although the panel towards the end of her crying about the way that she was raised, mm-hmm. does that not look like Marlon Brando from Superman?
A little bit. I think there's a lot of potential Katharine Hepburn voice as well for this character.
I was always taught that a woman was nothing if she wasn't a mother. I was one of the unlucky ones. No, man.
Norman Warren.
But they did a good job with that too, of making you feel for this woman who is, we've been conditioned to think, is evil. It makes you see things from her perspective a little bit as well.
Right.
So
the first of the villains in these issues that wasn't just outright evil, you know, kind of had some nuance
yep.
about her.
Yeah, very very interesting. And we also are left with the old timer making a very hard, very tough decision. Hal says that they're going to return to Oa and appeal his sentence, but the old timer says no. To my surprise, I find that the prospect of death does not greatly disturb me. Knowing that it will come, I will work. I will fill my days with deeds. Perhaps I can accomplish more in a decade than my immortal brothers do in centers. So, really, really cool way to wrap up for now, anyway, the old timer's subplot. What did you think of this issue, Nick?
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I thought it was cool getting to go to Maltus, which we had been to a couple times in the Green Lantern comics, but not overly often. And it was cool to see a different version of Maltus that was heavily populated. And we continue to get more character development from the old-timer. And it's clear at this point that this journey with Green Arrow and Green Lantern has actually changed this character. So again, while there are not necessarily threats or what's carrying over from issue to issue, you can see here a clear example of character development carrying over from issue to issue.
Yep, and so that brings an end to the chapters that we're going to be talking about in this edition. In the next edition, we'll be going through the rest of these stories, which will include the most famous issue of the run, Snowbirds Don't Fly. So you can look forward to that one. We're looking forward to that one as well. We've got a pretty unique take on it, I think. But before we get to that episode, let's kind of wrap this one up and talk a little bit more about this story. Big picture, after all the stories that we've read for this part, what do you make so far of Green Lantern, Green Arrow by Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams?
Oh, man, holds up just as well as it did the first several times I read it. An example of comics from a different era that have a different pace, but yet somehow maintain a lot of their potency and their relevancy and don't feel like just nostalgic anachronisms, you know, that feel irrelevant in this time and age. It's still a comic that is as groundbreaking and as revolutionary today as it was back then.
And like we said about the covers, they don't make comics like this anymore.
No.
The pace, the density, the fact that, you know, it actually makes me appreciate a lot of what people are saying about the bang for your buck idea, in that now a comic, if you don't read slow like me, a comic will take you, you know, 10 minutes to read. Back then, you know, you're looking at, you know, potentially a half hour, depending on the comic, even longer. So it's a different style of comic to get used to. But it's no less valid. It's really good. It holds up. I was especially this time blown away by the artwork. Neil Adams was an absolute genius, and I know that's not exactly a groundbreaking take or opinion.
Just ask him; he'll tell you.
Yeah, but if you've seen his recent stuff and you've been like, "Oh, I don't really get it. I don't understand the big deal with Neil Adams," read this stuff because it's incredible. And Denny O'Neil's writing, another revelation. Maybe it's been so long since I've read a Denny O'Neil comic that I forgot just how great his way with words was, his characterizations. But the way that they mesh together, some creative teams just mesh, if that makes sense. They just fit with what they're trying to do. And this felt like two guys that were on the exact same page with what they wanted to do with this title. And it really shows in every chapter. It really shows how the stories build, the characterizations evolve, the artwork just as good as anything you could find on the stands today. And that's saying a lot because I think comic book artwork has evolved a lot since the 70s. But this holds up. I mean, this is as good as anything that I buy now. So, and better than most. It's an incredible story. So yeah, highly recommended from me, that people check this out. Really looking forward to getting into the rest of this in the next episode, but, safe to say, Nick, that you would recommend this to folks.
Oh, at this point, absolutely. Absolutely. Really important for people to understand why this run is still so influential in the comics industry and why it's still talked about. I think this is, if you're looking to beef up your historical knowledge of the genre, this is one of the cornerstones that you need to start with.
And it's also another great example. We talked about this a little bit off the air, Nick. A great example of why there are multiple valid approaches to characters.
Yep.
Because this was a departure for Green Arrow. He was a Batman clone for many, many, many years. Yes, people out there who criticize Arrow for being like Batman, that's what Green Arrow was when he was founded. This was a drastic departure from everything that came before for his character. This was a departure for Hal Jordan in many ways from his established characterization. Not as much as Green Arrow, but like you said at the beginning, he had a little bit of that rebelliousness already in him. So they changed these characters a little bit, but it's equal.
Oh, Maul. Son of a bitch.
This was the defining take on the point. He hadn't been popular, and this run created the characterization that would build the basis for all of the Green Arrow solo series that came after it. Mike Grell, all the runs. Mike Grell, Kevin Smith, of course, Jeff Lemire. Mm-hmm. All of that is based, at least in some part, on the foundation laid by Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams here.
Absolutely agreed. You said it perfect, Bubba.
So anyway, that brings another end to another episode of The Long Book Hunters. We will return with another episode of The Long Book Hunters on part two of Green Lantern, Green Arrow. We will go through all the rest of the stories.
Next week's show.
And that's going to be coming up on next week's show, indeed. And tell the folks what else we might have coming their way, Nick.
You know, I haven't looked at our calendar in a little while, but I do know that coming down the pike, we'll obviously have another edition of Countdown that we need to flesh out the idea a little bit before we're ready to unveil it to the public. But we've also got a, let's see. Oh, we're finally, Greg, most excitedly, I don't even know if you know this, but on the schedule for the month of May, we have our long-threatened Superman Lives / Death of Superman Lives documentary off the page, where we're going to look at the script and the associated documentary that came out last year about the failed Superman Lives project. So we're finally trying to get that on the docket.
We better get to reading that script then.
That's a good point. But movie scripts you usually burn through pretty quickly because of, you know, the page count. They're typically, you know, the spacing and whatnot. It shouldn't take you. Take y'all that long.
That's going to be interesting because I've never read it. You've never read it. Going to be an interesting read.
I do know. I have seen the film, and the film is excellent. The documentary, I mean.
Right, and I have not. So looking forward to all of that. We've got all that coming your way. We've got a Hard Travelers for Hire coming up too long about the Iron Man 3.
Actually, Greg, we don't have another Hard Travelers for Hire until the month of July.
Oh, wow. Well, shows what I know. But I would also invite you all to listen to all of our episodes and our archives right here at Place to Be Nation Pop, and also listen to all of the other great shows on Place to Be Nation Pop. We've got Geek and Sassy. They've recently come out with a new episode. Got to listen to them. Got to listen to Seller's Points, which my cohort recently made a guest appearance that should be dropping in the near future.
I had dropped already. It's out there. It's on there.
Oh, I didn't see that. Well,
you even made a guest appearance on the show.
Well, hell, go check it out, folks, and go and I don't even know what I said. I must have been bombed out of my mind.
You know, the crazy thing is, Greg, neither does anyone else. They don't know what you said either. You were distorted by some sort of crinkling noise in the microphone.
Oh, wow, that's strange. Almost as strange as all of the weird cutouts we've had throughout this podcast between each other.
Yeah, I really don't know what to make of those. Those have been exceptionally odd.
I don't either, folks. We've had a little bit of technical difficulties in this podcast, and we're not really sure what the cause is, but when we find it, we'll beat it into submission.
That's right.
So Seller's Points, as I mentioned, Conversation Comics, don't know when a new one's going to drop of that, but really looking forward to that. Lucha Undead, Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular.
I hadn't seen one of those in a while. Is that still a thing?
We need a new one. We need a new one for me, and we've got the NBA team talking about the playoffs where my...
Good Lord, he said it properly!
Where my Utah Jazz have a 3-2 lead at the time of this recording over the LA Clippers. I hope I didn't just jinx them. I probably did. And your Atlanta Hawks are doing pretty well too, Nick.
Well, they're down. They lost on the day of this recording. They lost Game 5. But that's neither here nor there, because they play in the Eastern Conference, where literally only one of the eight teams matters. So, not really
right.
A huge deal.
In any event, folks, we invite you to join us and all of our other cohorts here at Place to Be Nation Pop. And if you're into pro wrestling, listen to all the great wrestling podcasts at Place to Be Nation. In the meantime, enjoy the week. Enjoy the return of DC television. I know that we're going to enjoy that.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find to bring some loving here today. Hey, Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on? Talk to me, you can see what's going on.